Good morning, members. We are going to be doing a bit of shifting around today, just because of where people are and where guests are coming from. So just know that that is the case. Know that the other cases, we are going to get through all these bills on the schedule this morning, because if you turn over your back sheet, look at that. That's our meeting for this evening, and I will remind folks again then. Representative Dill, where's Representative Dill?
Yes.
Would you like to start, please?
Oh, okay. I thought Representative Hoshes. Yes, we certainly will.
Representative Hoshes, folks have not made it down from St. Cloud yet, so I think what we're going to do is to start with you, and then we may interrupt you.
That's fine.
But I thought you would agree with that. Thank you.
No problem. Representative Hoshes has somewhere he needs to be, so
let's do it.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I don't see we have a quorum, so I won't move the bill at this point. We'll just present the bill. We're going to lay it over. Is that correct?
That is correct.
All right. So with me, this bill is about the Ely International Wolf Center, located in Ely. It's the International Wolf Center located in Ely. This is not the first time this proposal has been before this committee and the legislature. The building is owned by the state of Minnesota, correct? And the Wolf Center leases space from the state of Minnesota, as did the Forest Service. The Forest Service has built a beautiful facility just down the road. If I'm saying something wrong, hit me. And they are moving out of a portion of the building that is owned by the state, and that area is soon to be available for further activity at the Wolf Center. Today I have with me Mr. Medwig, who is the boss up at the Wolf Center, and he knows all of the intimate nuances and details of this. Now, Madam Chair, the way the bill is drafted, this appears to me that we're talking about money coming from the environment budget, from our budget, from our committee budget. And I know there are many pressing priorities for that money. And so the reason that I am bringing this forward, I mean, they would certainly like to have the money. But I'm trying to keep this in front of us so that when we come to the year that we can actually do this, which probably is next year, we'll be very familiar with it. So
super.
I just wanted to let you, I see you smiling, so that I think we're on the same frequency. Mr. Medwig?
Thank you for coming.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Walter Medwig. I'm the Executive Director of the International Wolf Center. And I've prepared an outline of our project, which I hope the members of the committee have before them. Again, it's about six different slides. Again, as Representative Dill has indicated, we are seeking funding to renovate this state-owned structure with the departure of the United States Forest Service. In way of background, the building is a state-owned structure, and we operate in a lease agreement with the Minnesota DNR. The building was built through a legislative appropriation of $1.2 million in 1990, plus an additional $800,000 from public and private sources. The building was designed to host the Forest Service's Boundary Waters Permit Station, as well as the Wolf Center, and that has been operating since 1993. Again, as Representative Dill has indicated, the Forest Service is building a consolidated facility to bring all of their facilities in Ely into one location, and that will be across the street from the Wolf Center. The current relationship is such that the Wolf Center pays lease payments to the DNR for about $26,000 a year. In addition to that, we pay about $50,000 per year in building costs, electricity, routine maintenance, custodial, etc. The DNR does cover major structural challenges, problems that may come up in the building. Our hope is to, again, take a building that was designed to house two different entities and convert it to serve the one entity, the Wolf Center. And so we want to restructure the admissions area, admission information, program registration, temporary exhibits, and also provide more services to visitors, such as rest and service areas. Background on our organization: we are a private 501c3 not-for-profit, non-advocacy, educational organization. We were founded by Dr. L. David Meech, the Minnesota's premier wolf researcher. We operate on a budget of about $1.6 million a year. We raise $850,000 in earned income through program fees, admissions, et cetera, and we generate about $750,000 in memberships and donations. We've got about 10,000 members across the country and beyond, with the majority in Minnesota. Other aspects of our organization, we don't receive any operating funds from state or federal sources. We've had visitors from all 50 states and some 38 countries. We've gotten, well, I should say, in response to a question from Representative Deal, we have gotten funding through LCMR for a couple of specific projects. But again, our operating funding is through our own resources. And again, just to conclude here, in 1996, the University of Minnesota conducted an economic impact study suggesting that the Wolf Center generates about over $3 million a year to the Ely area economy and 55 jobs. Since 93, that totals over $43 million. We've become part of the Ely experience. And the center, again, has become a major portal of wolf information. And that service will only continue with the Wolf's transition to State of Minnesota management, which happened officially on Monday with transfer of management from federal to state hands after some 34 years on the endangered species list. And again, why now? Forest Service moves out October or November of this year. As Representative Dill indicates, we were unsuccessful last year. And again, the space allows us to grow our organization. Again, that has been within that building for some 14 years now to serve specifically the public that, again, is coming to our facility for an ecotourism experience. I appreciate your attention and would welcome any questions that you may have, Madam Chair and members of the committee.
Any questions, Representative Bill? Would you like to make a final comment? But what we will lay this bill over for consideration when we have a quorum, so you must remind us to make that motion.
I think most people, Madam Chair, are familiar with the work of the Wolf Center. I did want to make reemphasize the point that they are, for all intents and purposes, self-sufficient. They don't come and hound us for money. The state owns the building. They lease it. If they get the new part, they'll lease that. And so, I mean, we're thinking a little along the lines of a business situation here. I mean, sometimes tenants or sometimes owners, landlords, have to invest in their property so that they can keep their cash flow coming. So that's kind of the way I look at it. They do a good job. There's thousands upon thousands of people there that go there and drool over the wolf when really all they got to do is come up to my house and stand on the deck at night and listen to the darn things out there chasing deer. So, I mean, you do a good job at that. They don't all get to come to my deck, but you are certainly welcome to come up there anytime.
Well, I was thinking that was an invitation, Representative. The committee will note that, and we will note that for the record.
Okay, that's it for us. Thank you very much
for
listening.
We appreciate your coming.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair.
Representative Hosh. Welcome to the committee. We don't have a quorum yet. We will listen, and when we have a quorum, we will move to have this bill laid over for consideration.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and giving some of your precious committee time to our bill before you. The bill before you would be an appropriation for acquiring some land in Stearns County, Minnesota. This would be a 265-acre chunk of land in St. Joseph Township, just west of the city limits of the city of St. Joseph, which is a rapidly growing community. There is a sense of urgency with this particular project. One is because of the negotiations and the with the current landowners of that property. The property is around Kramer Lake, which right now is about half developed. The shoreline is about half developed with single-family homes. It's the desire of the county to purchase the remaining acreage around that lake and to preserve it for a county park. I think there's a few unique circumstances in our area. One is we have no state parks in Stearns County, and that has been kind of an issue of contention for some time since we aren't able to compete for some certain funds throughout the state of Minnesota. And the second unique part of this is that the county has already stepped forward and made a commitment of bonding $1.25 million for this particular project, and they have also gotten $500,000 through an LCMR grant. So they're ready to move forward. We just need to find that remaining dollars to finish the land deal with the property owners. But with me today is Chuck Wolken, who is the Stearns County Park Director, who can address the issues with this particular project in much better detail than I. So I would like to hand it over to him, Madam Chair.
Welcome to the committee. Thank you for coming.
Madam Chair, my name is Chuck Wolken. I'm the Stearns County Park Director. For about 30 years, which is the duration of my tenure with the county, we've been trying to find a willing seller out in the Central Hills and Lakes area out by St. John's that would have a significant piece of property with lake frontage, some of the beautiful landscape features that you usually associate with St. John's University campus. We have a willing seller here, it's a family of with eight kids in, and we've been negotiating with them for a while. They want to get, as they say, get the deal done, and we say, well, that's fine. We'd like to do that too. We need some additional funding. This particular piece of property is on the Minnesota Biological Survey. Only 1.6% of our 1,400 square miles in Stearns County is on that biological survey, and about 95% of this site is on that survey. We're looking at approximately a half a mile of lake frontage on a good water quality lake. There's on the handout indicates there's 194 acres of surface area. Water clarity, according to the DNR, is 12 feet. The key part is that we have a willing seller, and in 30 years of searching, that's a pretty big deal for Stearns County. We're estimating the total cost of the project to be about $2.5 million, and as Representative Hosh has mentioned, Stearns County has bonded and set aside $1.25 million for this project. We don't have a final purchase agreement yet, but the family is very, very hot on us being able to close this deal, and we have some urgency with the LCMR funding that was set aside in 2005. That expires in June of 2008. So we're looking for your help to on this so that we can close the deal with the willing land sellers and preserve what we feel is an excellent representative landscape for central Minnesota.
Thank you. Representative Posh, have you been before the bonding committee?
Madam Chair, we have been. We're looking at all avenues.
You have been.
Yes, we have been in front of the bonding committee. Why we also did an appropriation because of the urgency associated with this project. I know bonding dollars are the traditional sources for projects such as these, but as Mr. Wolken has stated, the LCMR funds are contingent until June of 2008. The county has already bonded. The willing landowners who want to sell are looking for a commitment right now, and that's why we're here today. I'm always open to trying to find innovative ways to achieve this. If we can work in conjunction with the bonding committee or try to get some commitment today so we can move forward and Stearns County can move forward. The issue is they've already stuck their neck out. They've already bonded with, kind of the blind hope that we can finally come to conclusion on this project, but we need a little bit more help.
If I can understand correctly, you would have then another bill that's sitting before the bonding committee that is for bonding money, and this is for general fund money. So you have two bills to cover the same topic. That's fine. I just need to understand that.
Correct, Madam Chair. Okay. So we don't want to leave any stone unturned.
That is a smart move. So, yes, I appreciate that smart move. And I don't see questions for members yet. We will, when we have a quorum, lay this over for consideration. Thank you so much for coming.
Thank you for your time, Madam Chair, and to the committee members. If you do have any questions in the meantime, always feel free to contact. Appreciate your time.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative
Bill, would you like to return to the table? And I see we have a new fiscal note. Did you see that?
Do we have a quorum now?
Yes, we do have a quorum. I would note that we have a quorum, and with that, would move to lay over House File 328 and House File 602 for consideration in the omnibus Environment and Finance Bill.
Thanks, Madam Chair. I'd like to move for possible consideration in the Environment Finance Omnibus Bill, House File 299.
Representative Bill.
I also have an amendment, the 0284 amendment. And I'd like to move the amendment and then explain the amendment briefly. Madam Chair, members, this bill is probably the most complicated bill that I have done since I've been in the legislature in terms of the nuances of how it affects the people that live in the state of Minnesota, a major industry in the state of Minnesota, and the state of Minnesota. It is a very complicated bill. This provision is being brought forward, this amendment, to help enhance the quality and the characteristics of the bill. In the bill, the down payments that the loggers have paid or companies have paid towards the cost of a sale when they buy it at an auction, this bill as presented and engrossed has a provision that allows them to carry it forward to another future logging sale that they purchase out on the market. What this amendment does, Madam Chair, is this requires that the down payment on the turn back sale that they turn back to the state under the bill be credited first to a sale that continues to exist in their inventory of state sales. And then if they have no existing state sales after they turn back their wood, then it can be credited forward to the next or to future sales for the period of 2 years. And the reason that we did the amendment, the reason I did the amendment is because logging interests, including companies, came forward and said the number one thing we don't want to have happen is any speculative bidding of any kind, anyone trying to protect their 15%, the chance that they might lose their 15% if they didn't prevail in a future sale. So we got a list of all of the sales, and there's only one or maybe two permittees presently that do not have more than one sale under the $40 cap in this bill. So almost virtually everyone would be able to use the money first on an existing sale. One or two very small entities would have to then carry it forward. So just imagine very quickly if you're in a timber auction and you said, I've got 15% from a previous sale that's on the line, and for a dollar a cord I can protect my 15% and get it used up on this sale, and then someone else bids another dollar, and he says, well, I'll bid another dollar, and that's what we're trying to avoid with this provision. And it was well thought out. It was brought to be by industry, as a matter of fact, up in Bemidji. So with that, unless you have questions, I'd like to move adoption of the amendment.
Representative Bill has moved adoption of 0284 amendment to House File 299. I see no questions. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposition? The amendment has been adopted.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Now to the bill as amended. Madam Chair, this problem dates back with 1,000 different nuances that got us here. I mean, from a matter of the federal government being engaged in lawsuits, stopping timber production on the massive, copious quantities of federal land that exist in the state, the millions of acres. They are engaged in lawsuits over timber harvesting with environmental concerns, over EISs and about anything you can imagine to stop or to curtail logging on federal land. It has to do with how the state has put up wood. It has to do with how industry has expanded. It has to do with how loggers compete with industry to buy wood. It has, when industry is their customer, so they're competing between themselves trying to fill contracts of their own plus the people that they actually sell it to. So it's a very, very, very complicated situation. Well, in about 2004, we had an amazingly strong wood economy in that area. This is the 3 or 4 year area where you had a hurricane and you had incredible numbers of housing starts. Interest rates were exceptionally low, and I hope some of you benefited from that. And the demand for wood board, engineered wood board, was extremely high, and the price of wood board was well over $20 a sheet. Well over $20 a sheet. So then the hurricane kind of went away, and suddenly the housing starts have now plummeted to their lowest levels in recent history, somewhere down about 1.2 million a year, which was over 2 million originally, as I understand it, and the price plummeted, well, of the board, the product that the company sell. The problem is that during that time, the price of the raw material followed the price of the board up into basically the stratosphere, up into the $60, $70, $80, even $90 a cord, where loggers and companies were scrambling to get inventory to sell it into a market that could sustain it. But with the dramatic decrease in the market, they no longer can sustain those kind of wood prices and the raw material prices. So what we have, and the reason for the bill, is we have this huge backlog of wood that has been sold between 2004 and the beginning of this year that is priced double and a half, 2.5 times over the cost of what you could buy the same wood for today on the open market. So the risk that we are taking, the problem we are trying to come to some grapple with, get our arms around, is that we have hundreds and hundreds of thousands of cords of wood in the woods, standing in the woods, that is ready for market, that is mature, it's what the industry needs, that is priced so high that every time a logger turns the key in a piece of equipment and he cuts down one tree, he loses money. And he cuts down the next tree and he loses money. And then he delivers it by truck and he loses more money. And so what loggers have said is we are simply not, I'm not going to say all of the loggers, but loggers have said we are simply not going to cut that wood. And we are going to either wait for the market to recover, which to imagine recovering to that kind of level would be a phenomena that happened during that really perfect storm of events. And so where we risk as the state is this fiscal note that's before us, which is preliminary, by the way, this new one is not approved by the Department of Finance, as I understand. We risk in losing millions of dollars of income by doing nothing. And we risk losing millions of dollars of income by doing something. So it's a real tightrope that we are going to be trying to walk here. If the wood does not get cut, then we receive no revenue except for the 15% down payment, which is less than $2 million on all of the wood that we're talking about, from $40 a cord and up. If we take the wood back now and let them use that 15%, that roughly short of $2 million, and use it for their current inventory as a credit or for a future sale, then what we do is we get the wood repriced, we get it in a position where the industry can consume it, the logger can cut it, the logger can make a profit, and the state will receive funds. So it's kind of like my son when I tell him that I can afford to give him $50 a week in allowance when I've got a $100,000 job, and now my job is now $30,000, I can afford to give him $10 a week. That's the same situation. I mean, if we don't do something now, we will have no money coming in this next 3 to 5 year period while these timber permits are working out towards expiration, or nearly no money. Then the other problem with this whole situation is if we don't do something, and those permits run out their course, which is 3 to 5 years from this time, then the DNR will have to repackage the sales at that time and repackage them and sell them for another 3 to 5 years. So not only do we not have any income in the current contract period, but we'll have to wait another 3 to 5 years to get the same income that we thought we were going to get in the first period. And the wood will be standing in the woods all of that time. And believe me, folks, they cut this wood when it's the best for the industry, not when it just happens to be available. So it can get blown down by wind. It can get diseased. And it'll lower its quality. Then they're not going to pay as much for it at the end of that time. Plus, think of the jobs. Think of the people. Think of the families that are trying to feed their families and pay their health insurance and make a house payment and a car payment, and all the people that were laid off this last winter and in the industry. That is who is going to benefit from this. The state will receive their money when the wood is cut. When the wood is cut. Not before. So, I mean, we are doing something here that is not, there's no consensus on this in the industry. There's no consensus on this in the logging industry. And I tell you what, my feeling about it is, now, I'm not saying there's, it's not even 50-50, it's much more supported than that. Way more supported than that. But it's not consensus. Consensus is when everyone agrees. But it is just almost imperative, in my view, that we take this step now rather than wait and just do nothing. Because if we do nothing, we end up with nearly nothing. And so, I mean, I could go, I really would rather answer questions, and then Mr. Dane is here from the Associated Contract Loggers and Truckers, and he's worked with me, and we have traveled to the state, talked to logging entities and industrial entities, and trying to find a bill. We've made huge revisions in this bill since it was first introduced. We went from a very controversial bill in my Game and Fish and Forestry Committee to a bill that only, I think, received maybe one no vote when it passed out of that committee. It's just a much better document today than it was in the beginning. But I really think we need to focus on, and say it one more time, the fact that if we do nothing, people don't work. Mills don't run as efficiently. They can't consume this high-priced wood. Frankly, one more thing about this, is since this bill was done, and since this bill was drafted, and since we put the $40 cost on there, we have had call after call after call that says, drop the price $40 lower, because the mills have lowered their price to us, what they will pay us, by another $3 to $5 or $8 a cord. And if you don't drop it down to $30 a cord, the wood that's above $30 a cord is going to stand in the woods until our contracts expire. I'm still sticking with 40, but I mean, there's people calling all the time saying that you're going to leave now the $30 to $40 wood in the woods. But I feel like sharing the pain here is kind of has a lot to do with this. You know, sharing the pain in the state, the funds, sharing the pain at the logging entity, sharing the pain at the companies. So, with that, I'll Mr. Dane is here and he can speak to the bill.
Let's hear from Mr. Dane. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair, committee members. I couldn't say any better, to be honest with you. Representative Dill lives up there in the Cook area, Orr area, and we hear from his constituents and the people I represent with the Associated Contract Loggers and Truckers all the time. The situation is extremely desperate up there. I trust that everybody here can understand and appreciate the importance that the timber industry plays in the economy of Minnesota. Likewise, I assume that everybody recognizes, particularly after Representative Dill's explanation, the crisis that's threatening the industry in Minnesota. As a quick overview, I did provide some information to the committee, a print-off of a PowerPoint presentation. And I think that the two slides that are really worth looking at there, one is the, I think the second or third... It would be the comparison. Timber values, there we go. Timber value collapse. I think it really puts it in perspective. if you've identified that one there. I just want to run through it real quick. About timber values have plummeted 66% over the last 12 months. There are approximately 800,000 cords of timber out there that are extremely overvalued and will not be cut for the most part. And mills continue to reduce the price that they're willing to pay for delivered wood to the mills. Going on to the next page, it shows you the price structure under stumpage value versus delivered price. Just want to give you a quick overview of that. Minnesota mills currently pay $65 to $85 a cord delivered, depending on what which mill you're going to. Typical costs of harvest are $35 a cord to the logger. That's his harvest cost. Transportation costs are $15 a cord minimum. That brings you down to a combined production and transportation cost of $50 a cord. Delivered price by mills, again, $65 to $85, only leaves the logger $15 to $35 per cord to purchase wood. Loggers cannot afford to purchase timber over $40 a cord, or to harvest timber over $40 a cord. Kind of puts it in perspective. So you can see with the $60, $70, $80 cord wood out there, it's impossible for any business person to even harvest that timber. I've been talking to a lot of loggers lately who are trying to stay afloat. These are guys who are in their 60s, 50s and 60s. They're selling off land they own. They're refinancing their homes. They're doing anything they can to stay afloat right now. This legislation would provide one more tool in keeping them afloat until the industry recovers. Now, you've got a preliminary fiscal note in front of you, and in seeing that last week, the initial fiscal note, the associated contract loggers and truckers were concerned about the perception of that note, and so we received a document that is our interpretation of the impact. And the bottom line would be, as Representative Dill stated, that based on the harvest of that timber in the next 24 to 30 months, the state would actually realize a net revenue increase of approximately $10 million if this bill was approved.
And Chair, if you would look at the page 3 of 3 on the preliminary fiscal note, and you look down at the right-hand corner, it has a figure of $13,594,000 as potential revenue loss by doing this. That is based on the value of the wood that was sold during the auctions versus what it is estimated to bring as it's resold in the future. And that they're estimating $13,594 in revenue loss. That's, Madam Chair, is if we do the bill. That is if we do nothing. No, wait a minute, I got to get that right. I'm sorry. Correct. If we do the bill, they're estimating that we'll have a $13 million revenue loss. But, Madam Chair, I'd really prevail to you and ask you to consider this, members. If we do nothing, that number is going to be $30 million thereabouts. Revenue loss, because if we don't cut the wood at all during that period, all of the revenue will be gone, not just half of it. And so that is the real crux of this. One other thing I'd like to add about the bill as it's progressed through the steps is that when I originally drafted the bill, I had a $35,000 cord turnback on the bill. And we thought about that long and hard, and we looked at the number of permittees and who had the wood, and the companies logging, the industry has the largest number of cords, anywhere ranging up into the 90,000 cord range. And we thought, how can we target this to help the little guy the most? And so we lowered the number down to 10,000 cords so that the little guy got the most benefit, the small family loggers, and the industry got the least benefit, because I think all of those entities are a little complicitous in the price run-up and the bidding. And kind of, if you remember, I remember very distinctly when the NASDAQ was at 5,000 points. That was a very good day for me. It was a very poor day when it reached 1,200. I remember the Federal Reserve Chairman, Alan Greenspan, saying on CNN there was irrational exuberance involved in running the market up. And sometimes I think that that's what happens in these situations is irrational exuberance. Well, now we're on the other end of that spectrum. So this number of $13,594,000 is if we do the bill, but if we don't do the bill, it might well be $27 or $28 million. So with that,
Do you have anything else?
I'll just close, if I may. This legislation is not the solution to the timber industry crisis in and of itself, but it is one component of a comprehensive effort that's being looked at and addressed by all stakeholders. And that being said, the logging community respectfully requests that you give this legislation favorable consideration, and I'll be happy to answer any questions also. Thank you.
I think Representative Gunther's had a question, and we're going to ask DNR to come down and chat with us, and then we'll have questions for all of you. Representative Gunther.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Representative Dill, if loggers go out of business and there are fewer people to bid on these auctions, won't the revenue to the state ultimately stay down and they won't be able to get what they're getting today?
Well, Madam Chair, Representative Gunther, it's the worst thing, occurrence that could happen is that if the loggers can't survive and they leave, that we end up without the infrastructure to build, to actually harvest the trees. And so someone says, oh, that could never happen. So you're in there somewhere between nirvana and that situation that I described. And people say, that could never happen. Well, I can tell you that during this crisis, it's since September when Ainsworth kind of triggered this whole fiasco of closings, plant closings, taking a quarter of our wood supply out with it. The logging, the folks in Colorado contacted the loggers in Representative Anzell's district and my district, Representative Moe's district, and asked them to come to Colorado and bring their equipment and log the wood in Colorado, because the same similar thing happened in Colorado. Their infrastructure for harvesting wood failed because of their situation out there, similar, and they have no one to cut their wood. And the wood is standing, it's diseased, it's blowing over, they're having forest fires, and they've got a mess. So if you really look at what Representative Gunther mentioned, and I'm not suggesting that that happens in Minnesota, but somewhere between $25 a sheet for OSB board during a perfect storm of events of goodness, and where we're at today is where this will fall out in Minnesota. And what it's going to mean is more demand for people here at the legislature to provide more money for schools, because people are going to not be in the schools and they're going to be closing schools. They're going to have less economic development. There's less sales tax coming in. There's less motor vehicle fuel tax collected. And this thing just dominoes on down until we have a very limited or no wood industry at all. And that has happened in other places. I hope that isn't the case.
Okay, we're going to take two questions, and I do want DNR to come up so we have everyone here to chat with.
Well,
my question might be better after DNR. Madam Chair, I think my question might be better if I waited until DNR got there.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Dean, Representative Dill, we've had lengthy discussions about this bill, and I think we can all tell by the testimony of Representative Dill that this is something that he's passionate about and has committed hours, days, and weeks to this legislation. So, obviously, I thank you for that. Just a couple of questions. We have some differences of opinion about what will happen to this wood if we do this or not, and the intention of this, and I'll leave that alone because we've had that discussion in committee already. But we often talk about the small logger, and as we know, many of those loggers weren't able to afford to bid on this wood in the first place. And this might be for Mr. Dane, and Dave, Representative Dill, you can talk about this too. What additionally can we do for them? Because we can agree on that these are the people that we want to most help, but a lot of them don't have these state timber sales that we can provide that assistance to.
Madam Chair, Representative Mull. Well, first off, the bill as drafted and before you as amended will help those people that couldn't bid on the wood originally because they thought it was too expensive dramatically. And it's kind of, you got to think about that, have a kind of a paradigm in your mind about how that will actually work. But now we are going to put 700,000 or 800,000 cords of wood on the market that they can bid on if we do this bill. Before they said, we're smarter than this, the prices are too high, this isn't going to last. It's just like when the NASDAQ was at 5,000. I mean, you had buyers up the gazoo, but you had people that said, no way am I buying at that price because it's going lower. They were smart. But now they're going to even feel better, because when all of this wood gets put back on the market over this coming years, they'll have wood that they can bid at $25 a cord, $26 a cord, $27 a cord, and they'll have wood in front of their skidders and their feller bunchers rather than sitting at home. That is the benefit of this bill to the loggers that Representative Moe suggested. That is the biggest benefit of the bill. As beyond that, what we do with this bill and how we benefit those who couldn't bid on the wood and didn't bid on the wood, and not that they couldn't, but they didn't, is that we will do our best to help maintain an industry so that they can continue to work in that industry. That's the answer to your question, in my view, Representative Moe, is that this bill props up, allows to move forward the industry so that they can actually work. Because without the mills, there aren't truckers. Without the mills, there aren't loggers. Without the mills, there aren't your gas stations selling diesel fuel and the parts and the pieces and all of those things. And so that's the benefit to them. It's not as direct as the benefit to the people who have the sales, but that's the benefit.
Mr. Bain.
Madam Chair, Representative Moe, I'd just like to reiterate as well, an example that did occur in February, as you're aware of, with the turnback of 22 sales by 6 permit holders, and 13 permit holders, if I'm not mistaken, walked away with new timber contracts and stuff, some of them being the original, but just as many being new loggers.
Okay.
Welcome
to the committee. Madam Chair, members, my name is Bob Tomlinson with the DNR Division of Forestry. Excuse me. I'm not here as a DNR representative to say that we're for or against the bill necessarily, but we want to make sure that you have all the information that you need, all the facts and the figures, to make an informed decision on which way to go with this. We think we've provided you with that at different times throughout the discussions. I think this bill has been discussed at least three, this is probably at least the third different time over here on the House side.
These are different committee members, and some folks have not heard your understanding of what's going on. So I would appreciate it if you'd summarize your understanding of what's going on.
Sure. Well, let me try and put it in context with this, if I could. DNR sells timber off of state forest lands, produce revenue for the state and the trust and other. We currently have about 500 total permit holders in our system, in DNR. Altogether, they hold about 2,800 permits, different size sales, and those value of all those sales is about $100 million total. So in essence...
Can you say that number again?
$100
million. Okay.
So in essence, we have sold, the DNR has sold timber over the last several years, that has been sold but not yet harvested, standing out there on the stump, valued at about $100 million for the state. House File 299 will affect 372 of those permits, or about 13% of the total, held by about 138 permits. And as the fiscal note shows, the total current value of those permits was $24 million. So it's roughly 25% of the outstanding timber that's standing out there that's been sold but not yet harvested would potentially be affected by House File 299. Excuse me. The DNR takes, great value in having a vibrant, healthy logging community in the state. We value highly small independent loggers, the mom and pop type outfits up in northern Minnesota, and we value the bigger ones as well, and all the ones in between, because with them. They're basically the woods workers out there that help us keep the forest healthy and productive and do the silvicultural types of practices, mostly harvesting, that we recommend. We feel that Representative Gill has done a pretty good job over the last month, 6 weeks, I guess, of winnowing down, if you will, the original bill, which was fairly broad, and it's winnowed down now to a point where it's fairly focused. And I guess maybe one other thing that I could provide you with is a copy of where the different revenues go in the state, if that would be helpful.
Before you do that, and I think that would be helpful, but before you do that, you said the 13% of the permits in the bill, or $25 million of value, but you didn't say how many permit holders. How many permit holders are involved here?
It says there are 494 permits held by 176 permittees that include Aspen greater than $40.
Say that again.
Right, and item 4 on page 2 of the fiscal note under assumptions, in parentheses, the third line, it says there are 494 permits held by 176 permittees that include Aspen greater than $40 a cord within the 10,000 cord cap.
Representative Gill, but that would be for all Aspen. I think what we need to look at is the run right above it there. There's 372 permits affected, held by 138 permittees,
okay,
where Aspen is the predominant species.
Oh, okay.
And that was the difference between the first fiscal note and the second one that you have before you know.
So the question I'm trying to get at is how many folks are actually involved in this bill?
138 permits.
Potentially 138 permits.
So there are 138 people, or is it 100? Can you break down between people and entities for me?
There, Madam Chair, there's. I'm looking at that list. Mr. Dane and I looked at that list. It looked like about somewhere in the neighborhood of 9 to 10 were companies that were companies such as Boise or Ainsworth, Potlatch, those types of entities. There were one or two of those 10 that were wood merchants that buy wood and then resell them to loggers. And then all of the rest, about 130, I think it was, 135, is that right, Mr. Dane? Were family, corporations, some of them corporations, some of them sole proprietorships, that are the loggers. They're your neighbors and people with the equipment sitting in their yard. So, I mean, as I said, we whittled the bill down, as Mr. Thomason said, we whittled the bill down so that we focus in on them rather than focusing more broadly. Hope that answered your question.
Madam Chair, to that point, Madam Chair.
What?
Representative Magnuson. Well, and Representative Gill, how many people does that employ? And are these permittees, are they individual families, or are they a whole range of folk? It would be my assumption that the permittees may include like 10, 15 families. I don't know, employees or whatever.
I'll give you an example. Up in my little home community there, you have the Sokolowski family. That's five. They're a permittee. That's Sokolowski Logging Incorporated. There are five individual families, man and wife, and all of their kids are the permittees. I mean, I think that's just the question you ask. I mean, a permittee is someone that went an entity and went and bought a sale. But in my neighbors, the Sokolowski, Jeff Sokolowski and his family, and then all of the other Sokolowskis, I mean, they're very well known in the logging business. That's talking about five individual families, husband and wife. I'm just guessing they have 10 or 12 kids. And then the other Sokolowskis have all the trucking business, and that's another three or four families. So that's kind of the answer to your question.
Okay. Representative Enzo, we're going to watch the time now.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Quite frankly, committee members, and especially Representative Magnus, this is kind of the nub of the issue, and for me, it's the only reason why this would be the least bit difficult a bill to make a decision on. And I would just share, again, one size doesn't fit every permittee the same way. The bill will affect different operations in different ways. It'll affect trucking versus the logging side differently. And lastly, very anecdotally, the nearest community to me is a little community by the name of Marcel, 4 miles away. And there's a family there that literally, in a good year, represents way over half of the total economic activity in the entire community of about 65 people. I mean, literally, at one time or another, depending upon how good times are in the woods, everybody is employed. And that's why it just seems to me that Representative Dill has done a fantastic job with all the stakeholders here, and that we need to support his legislation.
Madam Chair, you have been so generous with your time at this committee, and so significant of a problem, and so significant. I just want to tell you that my last thing I really have to say about this is that it really is the outcome that we are expecting to expect of this. It's kind of like the Purolator oil filter commercial. You can either pay me now or pay me later. Well, I think we need to do something so that we get paid now rather than not get paid later. And that's kind of my closing statement. I mean, if we're going to focus on outcomes for the state, then we just have to move forward in some bold fashion. And this is going to hurt. I mean, plain and simply, this will hurt to recognize the fact that we sold $24 million worth of wood that's now worth $13 million. Buy a stock on the stock exchange and look 2 months later when it goes down half the price, how does that feel? That is what the state's position is. We got stock that we thought was worth $50 a share and it's worth $25. And there's not any chance really that it's going to come back up. And in the interim, thousands upon thousands of people are going to be hurt. So that's my closing statement, unless you have further questions.
I worry that we are still on a downward trajectory. Representative McNamara.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. I'll try to make mine really quick. Representative Deal or Mr. Tomlinson, can you tell me how many of the sales are bonded sales as opposed to cash deposit, approximately, or is that not known?
Mr. Dane thinks that he can answer that question.
Not to speak for Representative Dill or Ms. Tomlinson, but I did have a chance to speak to Gaylord for the DNR yesterday, and with the new database, he was able to identify the percentage of these sales that would be affected that are bonded, and that was about 28% of these sales, according to Mr. Gaylord. Peterson?
Okay, and then thank you, Madam Chair. And Mr. Dane, my next question would be then, so the reality is, it's not a big deal, but if we move forward on this, the bonded folks would actually not have to pay back interest, and that potentially could be for, they might have posted that bond 2 or 3 years ago. I'm just wondering if it wouldn't be appropriate. I'm also thinking there's another bill out there that deals with this issue. In case Representative Dill's bill didn't go forward, that we would allow the bonded people to just post a cash deposit. I'm thinking that we probably should be requiring them to do that at 6% per year or something, potentially, because otherwise, in respect, we're almost penalizing the small loggers more than the bigger ones are the ones that, you know, and maybe if they pay to 1% for their bond, you know, I just think we should charge them like 6% interest or something.
Madam Chair, in Representative Manziel's forestry bill is a provision that I put in the bill that came to me from industry, actually, that allows in the future, when the bill is passed, when Representative Manziel's bill is eventually passed, if that provision remains, would allow the industry to convert from a bonded sale where they're totally 100% guaranteeing, it's an irrevocable letter of credit posted by the company, allow them to convert to a 15% sale. And in that provision in Representative Manziel's bill is exactly what Representative McNamara is saying. What it says is that in order to convert to the 15% for bonded, you must pay interest from the day that you posted the bond till the day that you convert. And frankly, Madam Chair, that is another nuance that could improve this bill, at least from our perspective from the state. It will not make it as attractive to the companies. But, I mean, we're not talking about a huge amount of money, but I certainly would be willing to incorporate that in the bill here before it is put in the omnibus bill. That's a very good point, I think, unless Ms. Tomlinson has any further thing on it.
We're going to watch our time here. This is the very last question, and that is Representative Peterson.
Thank you, Ms. Chair. Representative Dill, and to others, the financing seems to be a little more complicated and nuanced in this, but I'll remind committee members that I think about 3 years ago, we had families from southern Minnesota and southwestern Minnesota in here asking for changes to the renewable energy production incentive amount, the 1.5 cent credit per kilowatt hour for wind production. And there were some problems delivery of turbines and timing of projects, getting that done and financing. And we did make that change to the financing and included everybody in the list and on the list. So if this seems to meet the guidelines set out by the DNR and there's some the financing or some bottlenecking or whatever it is that you know more about than me, I'm willing to, keep the committee's interest on this issue, but just saying that there has been times when we have helped those through policy that have run into trouble and through no fault of their own.
Okay. Representative Moe wants to make a statement.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. I think I need to just address a question that you put on the table, that you feel like we're still on a downward trajectory, and I would argue that we probably are. I mean, this is going to whatever we do with this bill, we are. This will provide relief for some aspect of the industry, but we have a governor's task force that has some very solid recommendations, that many of which are before this committee, that are going to help our industry into the long term. And I think we also need to focus our attention on that. This is not our solution. This is whatever we do with it. This is helpful for now. But we've got the Forest Resources Council before us in our budget, a basic study for the forest lands in general in the state of Minnesota, our private landowners program. You and I have talked about that extensively, and some other things that are actually looking forward into the future. How can we make this industry more sustainable, more successful into the long term for the families that we're trying to help here? So I just wanted to put that on the table for the committee, that this is one step for a much larger solution that many of us have spent a lot of time on.
Thank you, Representative Dill, and folks, for coming and testifying. My remark really was about the economy and the lack of building that seems to be going on and seems to be more generous.
And, Madam Chair, you have been so generous with your committee time. This is really a pleasure to have this amount of time. Thank you very much. This is so important, and you've just been so generous. Thank you.
Representative Olin, we are going to lay over House File 299 for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.
Madam Chair,
yes.
I think I'm going to let Representative Leader take his first, because there's a lot of people that are from my district and his district that are here in the Watershed District.
Okay, super. Thank you. So. Representative Leader, and then we will... Representative Leader, welcome to the committee. We're glad to have you here.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Leader has House File number 733, and we will have hearings on it, and I will then move to lay it over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. We do have an amendment also.
All
I don't know the number of the amendment that you have. I have the amendment, but I don't have the number in the bill that I have.
Well, we have to go through a larger pile here. Now, I don't have an amendment. Is there an amendment?
Madam Chair, I understand the amendment wasn't drafted. I can make an oral amendment to the bill, if I may.
You tell us what it is, and I will move the amendment.
Actually, substitute $400,000 for the year. I'll read it the way I have it, Madam Chair, if that's okay.
Yes.
It reduces $650,000 to $400,000 each year to reflect the amount of the state match and for the ring dike. So actually, the time you see $650,000, should substitute $400,000 for $2,000 this year and $400,000 for next year.
Members, on line 1.6, we're going to remove the two $650,000 and substitute $400,000. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposition? The bill has been amended. Representative Leader.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And the reason for that is another watershed district that was not normally included has requested to be involved in the total amount. Madam Chair and members, the bill, House File 733, deals with what we call ring dikes. And for you that may not be familiar with what they call a ring dike, any area which this represents, the Red River Valley, is relatively flat as a pancake. Normally, a fall on a mile, in other words, a fall for water to run is about a 1/2 foot per mile. So you can imagine when we get water and back up from rivers, that area is inundated for miles, and it's just not a small area. And what happens, the farms that are built practically on that land, because normally you don't raise your building sites or your farm buildings that high, are become inundated with water and flooded. And that's happened for quite a number of years since we've had flooding in the valley. For the past number of years, the department and the state has been involved in building what they call ring dikes. In other words, they build a dike around the farmstead. And this bill would practically complete that procedure, which has been involved, I think, basically since 1965 or 70s when we had floods up there. The watershed district, in cooperation with the farmers and the state, build the ring dikes, and that eliminates the problem of all the damage we have in the floods. Usually their storage buildings, like even where they store grain, and all their buildings become flooded. This way now, with the ring dikes that have been built, that eliminates the money for state and FEMA coming back in and trying to restore and rebuild, and it lets the farmers stay particularly in their homesteads and in the land. And it's been real successful. I do have a picture that we could show, but for time, I think you understand what it is. So what this would do, it would hopefully complete all the ring dikes that have been requested from the watershed for the next 2 years. And we think, unless there'd be another major flood with some other type where it would extend further, this should be the extent of the request for ring dike monies. And I do have Mr. Nargang here that represents the Red River Basin. Also, I believe we have a lot of our watershed districts in the audience. So if Mr. Nargang, I think he was around here. There he is.
Okay.
I know if you have
something.
Excuse me, I'm getting confused. Yeah, Mr. Arnack.
Okay, well, let's wait for just 1 second to see. I'm not sure that there are questions on this, Mr. Arnack. Are there any questions from members? I think folks have a good understanding of this particular issue. I don't see any questions. Is anybody in the audience like to say something, or shall we just lay this bill over for possible inclusion? I don't see anybody who wants to testify. So, thank you for coming. Representative Leader, we're going to the chair is going to move to lay House File Number 733 over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, members, and also Representative Boland.
Okay. Representative Boland?
Madam Chair, the same rule applies to Representative Eakin's bill as the next one. The same people are here.
Okay, Representative Eakin. Wonderful. We love to have people here that move things along so fast. Again. Representative Eakin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members, I'd like to move House File 1126 for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. And what this bill does is it's it resulted actually that there was a creation of a mediation conflict resolution process because there were problems in the 90s during some of the flooding problems we'd had. There were difficulties in moving forward with any flood mitigation projects because of conflicts with federal and state regulatory agencies, also conflicts with environmental organizations through litigation, and it really brought flood damage reduction projects to a stop. So this mediation conflict resolution process was put in place to try to address that issue, to bring all the stakeholders, all the participants, all the interested parties together to try to work things out. Yet it has been very successful. It resulted in 1998 to the Red River Mediation Agreement, and this again brings together all interests in working together to reach a general agreement on how to address the flood damage problems we're experiencing in the Red River Valley. The regulatory agencies participate to identify problems early on so that you don't end up with the problem of a project getting very far down the road and then suddenly an agency coming in with some problems that they didn't voice early on because they weren't part of the process early on. So it's bringing everybody together in the very beginning stages of the process to make sure all problems are identified early on, so you don't have wasted time and wasted resources down the road. This process was cut back greatly during the budget crisis that we experienced over the last 4 years. There were significant cuts made to that. What we're asking for today is simply a partial restoration of some of the funding cuts that resulted over the last 4 years. It asks for a restoration of about $100,000, and again, this is just a partial restoration. But again, this will go to accelerate the project work team efforts to make sure, again, that these things are being done in the most efficient manner possible. It goes a long way towards reducing the animosity that has previously existed to and still does to a certain degree, but not to the degree that it once did, between the agencies and between the environmental organizations and between the landowners and others who are interested in these projects. The outcomes, there are very many beneficial outcomes to this project. Cost-effective flood damage reduction, as I already mentioned. Also, cost-effective ways dealing with natural resource enhancements, improved water quality in the Red River Basin and the tributaries, reduced conflict, greater public involvement, virtual elimination of the litigation, and accelerated implementation of the projects. And with that, I would like to introduce Jerome Beal, who is here to testify.
Welcome to the committee.
Now, Jerome Beal, I'm co-chair of the Flood Damage Reduction Work Group, and we would like to get this $100,000 added. The work group has done fantastic in keeping the state out of lawsuits and litigation, but it's a new approach that we have up there. We have all the agencies, federal and state, and as these project teams progress, that they have local landowners on them, and we're getting just tremendous results. Our projects are coming faster. We're not having watersheds spend a whole bunch of money on a project that's going to be stopped, and we're on the process right now of even having Corps regulatory into the process, where the Corps will take concurrent steps so that we don't have to back up. So it's been a melding of flood damage reduction and natural resource enhancements that on a level that I never thought would have been possible. So any problem that comes up, we have the agency, the people at the table. So we would appreciate getting a little back. That 210 got pretty skinny for us to keep the project teams up. Thank you.
Thank you. Is there anybody else who would like to testify to this? Do I see any questions from members or others? I don't see any questions. With that, you will renew your motion to have House File 1126 laid on the table for consideration in the omnibus bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members.
Thank you. Representative Olin, it is now time.
Thank you, Madam Chairman, and thank you for allowing those people to go first, because they're almost all from my district, which means they're at least 5 to 6 hours away from here.
Well, thank you, and I am going to move House File 364 be recommended to pass and sent to the Finance with the recommendation that it further go to Ag Finance.
Okay. With that, I'm going to make a few comments here. First off, before I start, I'm going to see what kind of historical knowledge I need on this. How many of you are familiar with the bovine tuberculosis problem in northern Minnesota?
I think we're good.
You're good? Okay, so I won't go into the background history then, which will keep my comments very short. The amount of money that I have requested in this bill is similar to what the governor had in his request for the next 2 years. But I'll be honest that I'm asking for the $132,000 to be used on the bovine tuberculosis problems that are in the deer herds right now. The governor's proposal would probably be broader than just the $132,000, because they're covering additional things, because Ed Bogus is here from the DNR has indicated that to me. So on that part, I'm requesting $132,000 for bovine tuberculosis, because the problem hasn't been solved yet. And whether it'll be solved this year, it better be, because if it isn't, we've got a major problem out there. We're working with the federal government finding other sources of funding. In fact, you'll find on the troubleshooting, et cetera, that's going on right now that a lot of you have heard about and know about, the federal government has poured far more money into it than the state of Minnesota has at this stage. The Department of USDA has been doing a good job of assistance there. The other point that I am asking money, and this was in the governor's budget last year, and we were hoping $54,000 had taken care of the problem, but I'm requesting an additional $54,000 for fencing of the cattle feeding areas to keep the cattle and the deer away from each other in these areas where the problem is. As we all know, it started with the deer, or the cattle originally, and now is into the deer, and keeping those two entities on the same feeding area isn't going to solve the problem. So they need the money on the fencing. So the $54,000 would be additional funds, doesn't exist anywhere else, and I really think there is a need for it. There is a need for it. I have Dr. Hartman here for support if anybody wants to know exactly what the status of what's going on now is. He's got a meeting with the cattlemen up north tonight, he's indicated. And I also have Ed Bogus here from the DNR who can explain any questions you may have on what the shooting program or anything else is presently doing. I won't call them as witnesses, and those are basically my comments.
Members, are there questions here?
Good bill.
So, members, this one we're going to vote on because we're going to move it on to another committee. The motion is to recommend House File 364 be recommended for passage, sent to Finance with a further recommendation that it go to Ag Finance. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposition?
Thank you.
Next, we have Representative Lilly. Is she here?
Yep.
Okay, fine. You know, people can hide in this room. Welcome to the committee, Representative Lilly.
Good morning, Madam Chair and members. It's been really interesting.
Representative Lilly, since you're not on the committee, I am going to move House File 1522 to be recommended to be considered in the omnibus bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. In the Senate, they sent it on to the capital investment, so I'm not certain.
Would you like it sent to the capital investment? I think it.
But either way, I mean, I trust your judgment and wisdom.
You have asked that the money be appropriated from the general fund.
Okay.
It is my assumption that this is bondable. Let me just talk to our.
Madam Chair, trail projects are bondable, yes. May have to be worded a little different. I'm not sure if this is a state or local trail. It would have, if it was local, it would be a grant to the local from the DNR. But yes, trails are bondable projects.
Do you think we should?
Madam Chair, the committee obviously could choose to fund it out of general fund, but it would be rare in most instances to make this. Committee has not very often, and I can't even remember a time of funding trails out of general fund. They typically are bonded.
I think then we are going to pass it on. So why don't we hear your testimony, and then we'll change the motion.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. I'm sorry for the confusion. This is an enhancement to a current trail that goes through my district and other districts. It's a great trail, the DNR Trail, the Gateway Vento Trail. We have a major project that's going on currently, and that's why we were hoping to bring it up now, with the Highway 36 renovation and reconstruction going through our communities. And we were thinking that there might be some cost savings since they're going to have a lot of equipment in the area, that they might be able to do it at the same time. It is one of the highest use trails in the state of Minnesota, and is a great asset for the whole East Metro. I think my testifier can say where exactly it goes, but I've used it. It's great for rollerblading and biking, and people come. You can actually take it pretty close to here. It ends pretty close to St. Paul or the Capitol here. And so, anyways, it's Highway 36 is a real tight corridor, and it's a real high risk. I mean, there's a lot of it's a real at 120. It's a really a tense intersection. So it's kind of an extreme public safety situation. Cars are moving fast, and people are crying across the highway there, 120 and 36. And so anyways, it's a public safety thing, and it isn't specifically for us. We're kind of thinking it's the right time for savings, and it really isn't even a North St. Paul project per se. So I'm going to pass it over to my testifier, who knows much more than I do. This is Scott Dudick. He's from the city of North St. Paul, but we're a pretty small city, and he does everything. I have sometimes a hard time saying what he does. He's a fire chief, public safety director, he's community development. Anyway, so I'll pass it on to Mr. Dudick. Thank you.
Mr. Dudick, welcome. Just for a few brief comments, since we are going to be sending it to bonding committee.
Madam Chair, well, thank you, members of the committee. As Representative Lilly has stated, this trail crossing at Highway 36 and 120 is a highly traveled area with traffic, and with this project that we're doing with the highway project currently, which will be starting April 2nd, is a $31 million project, and we see this as a small piece to eliminate our last at-grade crossing by this request for this tunnel, which would very much enhance this state trail, which is connecting to William O'Brien State Park, eventually will connect to Duluth on the Munger Trail. It's the highest used trail in the DNR's program, and we ask for your support and very much thank you for your time and conscious of what time you have spent this morning.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a comment for Representative Lilly.
there's several of us here on the bonding committee, and tomorrow is our last day that we're hearing bills for possible inclusion this year, so I don't even know if the bill can get processed fast enough, but we probably want to talk to Representative Hausman to see if he can get on the end of the list for tomorrow's hearing.
Thank you, Representative Tingelstedt. Do you have a question?
Yes, Madam Chair, we might want to clean the language up so it does say bonding instead of general fund.
All right. Would you want to make that motion?
I will make that motion. The Chair of Council will help us on the wording.
Council, would you like?
Madam Chair and members, we just would delete general on line 5 there and put bond proceeds fund, and then there's boilerplate language that I'll put in later for section 2 to take the money from the bond proceeds fund for this purpose.
Do folks understand Representative Osmond's motion? All those in favor say aye.
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 Any opposition? Motion carries. All right. The bill now, member, is before you, and I will move that House File 1522 be recommended to pass, sent to capital investments as amended. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposition?
Thank you very much, Chair and members. Thank you.
Thank you.
Representative Hansen, this is the last one for this morning. Members, while he's getting up there, note our agenda for this evening starting at 6:30. You all will have a choice of how late you will want to stay here with me this evening.
You have a choice.
Yes. Yes. How much conversation we have, how many questions we ask will be how long we stay. Yes, that's what I mean by that. Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I will be brief. This is an existing program, the Roadsides for Wildlife program. It is effective in helping wildlife. It puts grass in the ground that provides habitat along our right-of-ways. It's a good program. The past 2 years, it's been funded with a one-time general fund appropriations. I have with me DNR staff who could briefly answer questions if needed. The appropriation in front of you would help expand the program to reach more people. And I move House File 1373 for be laid over.
Let me ask, we're just asking a question up here. Is this in addition to the governor's dollars?
The intent here, the governor has put $100,000 per year in from the Game and Fish Fund. I received this bill from Senator Chaudhry. His intent is that this would be essentially $50,000 more per year. This bill has it coming from the general fund. I'm kind of agnostic on where it comes from in terms of providing. The goal here would be to provide $50,000 more than what the governor is recommending.
Are there questions from members? I don't see any questions. Would you like Representative Hansen has moved that House File 1373 be laid over for consideration, and that's what we'll do. Laid over for consideration. Members, that's it. We'll see you tonight. You can adjourn. We'll start the meeting. Meeting comes to order. This is an award. This will be laid over for possible inclusion in the finance bill with the possibility that some might go to bonding. But let us start with yours. And I will move House File 1788. We don't have a quorum yet, but we will make sure that when we get a quorum, we will lay it over for possible inclusion.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative John Ward with House File 1788, which is a bill about the Minnesota Forest Productive Research Cooperative. And I have two testifiers with me today, members, Madam Chair, that are going to talk to the bill's points. So I'll just turn it over to them. They'll introduce themselves, and we'll take questions after that.
Madam Chair, members, I'm Bob Bowden with the Natural Resources Research Institute in Duluth, and my job there is to find funding and for new projects that we have. This is an unusual project for me to be involved in because it's not a new project, but it's a very important one, and it provides $400,000 of base funding in our forestry department, and which accomplishes very good work in that area. With that, I'm going to just turn it over to Bill Ferguson, who is the director of that particular area, to explain what this is about. Thank you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Bill Bergeson. I'm a program director at the Natural Resources Research Institute in the forestry area. As many of you know, the forest industry has undergone some fairly significant strain as of late with the closure of Blandon's line and also closure of some mills that have been owned by Ainsworth Lumber. Part of that reason has been the high wood prices and a very tough situation in the procurement situation with raw material. As many of you know, the governor has put together a task force to look at the issues that surround the competitiveness of the industry and try to recommend some changes. Part of that, the recommendations that came out of the task force on the competitiveness of the forest products industry related to timber supplies as well as productivity of the forests, which has a direct bearing on future timber supplies. Actually, as part of that report, one thing that was highlighted was the fact that Minnesota has some of the lowest productivity forests in the world. We're way behind Scandinavia, way behind Brazil and some of the South American countries and others who are fairly aggressive on forest management. So what was proposed is that we would form a research cooperative involving industry, state government, as well as county government land managers to try to rectify that situation and do what we can to increase productivity of the state's forests. So what we're doing is, what we've done is formed a cooperative with many of the forest products industry representatives in the state. For example, Blandon Paper, Potlatch Corporation, Forest Capital, formerly Boise Cascades land managers, Minnesota Power, Verso Paper, which is a central Minnesota operation, the Sartell Mill. So there's a variety of industry as well as the state DNR and the county involved. What we're trying to do is really look at ways that we can enhance management. We've identified the primary species of interest for us has been aspen, which is a big part of the forest products industry's procurement. Red pine, which is a really owned by many ownerships and lends itself well to fairly intensive management. So we feel that we can really make a significant impact there. Also, we are working on hybrid poplar, which is a very fast-growing species. I have a disc here today. This is an 11-year-old tree that was grown in northwestern Minnesota. You might want to pass that around. What that entails is breeding to increase the genetic diversity as well as the growth rate of hybrid poplar, and looking at management techniques to basically maximize growth as much as possible. This actually has seen a real-world commercial application by Verso Paper They've established about 20,000 acres of hybrid poplar, and that's actually supplying about half of their total raw material supply for the Verso paper mill at Sartell. So that is kind of a thumbnail run-through of the research that we're involved in, and some of the players in the research cooperative. And with that, I'll be happy to answer any questions.
Are there questions for members? As you've been working on the hybrid poplar, have you found ways to limit the pesticide use and keep our beekeepers happy?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, yes, we have. We've done what we can as far as trying to find species that don't really require as much insecticide, especially. And we have worked with some of the practitioners to look at different chemicals that don't really impact the bees at all. So they're making headway along that in that line.
Are there any other questions for members? I was reminded that I did not recess the meeting. We recessed the meeting this morning rather than ending it. So we do have a quorum, and I will move that House File 1788 be laid over for possible inclusion in the Omnibus Bill. Thank you all for coming.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members.
Representative Saylor. Welcome. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. Do I need someone to move the bill? I would be glad to move the bill. This is House File 1903, and I'll move the possible lay it over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. If you'd like to introduce your witnesses, yes, we'll outline the bill.
And Madam Chair, if I may first, I do have one oral amendment.
Yes.
Would you like to take care of that first? That is on line 1.8. After the comma, after jurisdictions, comma, just strike the words including Native American reservations.
All right. Let's understand that on line one. I will move the amendment on line 1.8, striking the comma, including Native American reservations, another comma. Any questions by members? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. In opposition? The amendment has been passed.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This bill is a very short little bill, and I do have two testifiers, which I will introduce at this time. Gene Larimore with the Jack Pine Coalition, and Mr. John Winters with Beltrami County, works on their trail plan. And it's the intent of this bill basically to be in response to information for what we've been hearing back from counties, from stakeholder groups, individuals, that there needs to be additional enforcement of laws that we currently have on the books. There's no intention to change any current laws at all with regard to APB use. This is simply to be responsive to what I've been hearing from so many of the constituent groups and local government units and others that we need to have additional enforcement of current laws. And so that is what this bill is about. And I guess at this point, I would just ask Mr. Winter to make a few brief comments about the county's position.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, John Winter, I'm with Beltrami County. I'm the Natural Resource Recreation Manager. And Beltrami County just recently completed a trail plan for the whole county, and we're now moving into a second level of planning that we will be planning six parks, the basic parks the county has, as well as some more detailed trail planning and looking at things. And on the ATV issue, basically what I would say, no matter what position you take, open, closed, limited, whatever it is, it is a very complex issue. And in any additional enforcement would be very beneficial and helpful.
Gene Laramore with the Jack Pine Coalition. I support House File 1903 because it is a first step towards protecting the Mississippi Headwaters State Forest from ATV damage. It is certainly not the only step that should be taken, but it is the first step. I have surveyed parts of the forest, Mississippi Headwaters State Forest, on foot, and a year and a half ago, I was with a group of people who we paddled much of the Mississippi Headwaters, so I've kind of seen it from the water as well. Let me remind members that this is the last large semi-wilderness stretch of the river on the entire Mississippi, all the way from Lake Poitrain in Louisiana to Lake Itasca. This is about it. The stretch of river that Mississippi River runs through the Mississippi Headwaters is rich in the history of north central Minnesota. It was an integral part of Native Americans, used it not only as a source of food, wild rice and fish and whatever, but also as a way of moving around. Early explorers of Schoolcraft and Father Hennepin, of course, also traveled on that stretch of the river. Almost for that reason alone, it deserves more protection than usual. The Mississippi Headwaters contains wildlife and plant communities that are of great concern. That phrase "of great concern," of course, is from the DNR's publication about creatures that are not only threatened and endangered, but have other. This is a slightly more expansive than those two concepts. In other words, this is the Mississippi Headwaters State Forest is kind of an icon of north central Minnesota. And it's kind of headwaters country is what I suppose chambers of commerce up there talk about. It is a major tourist draw. The problem is that we have continuing, and it seems to get worse every year, illegal ATV riding that is degrading the symbol of Minnesota. Illegal ATV riding, some of which I've seen, anyone can, it's not difficult at all, include riding across a river, fording the river in effect. The place where that was the most annoying to see was at a camping spot called Coffee Pot, where there's a bridge across the river. Right next to the bridge, the ATVs crossed. We went up the other side and started to create one of these trenches that they do in slopes. ATVs ride up and down the riverbed itself. That's seen quite often. And this past summer, fortunately, a CO was able to nab three or four guys doing that. There are some at a place called Stumpage, which is another campground, beautiful place. Also, where there's a bridge cross, for what that's worth. A favorite spot of illegal and disrespectful ATV riding. It's got very, very high slopes up from the river, and you see ATVs using those slopes as a mini challenge kind of area. So for that reason, and many others, I think more enforcement would help. Again, it's just the first step, and I hope in the future to be able to present to you other kinds of steps that should be taken.
Thank you. Is there somebody in the audience would like to testify? All right, I haven't seen anybody. Are there quick questions here? We have lots of bills tonight, so
Is there any questions? I don't see any questions. So, House Bill 1903 will be laid over for possible inclusion.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members.
Okay, we will have Representative Dominguez, House File 1045. Okay, then we will just go on. People will have to come and go as they do. Representative Solberg is not here, and neither is Representative Ann.
Madam Chair?
No.
Okay.
He's right outside? All right. That is all right. We are going to just jump around a little bit tonight with House File
278.
And,
I'd like to move House File 278 for possible inclusion in the Omnibus Environmental Finance Bill.
Do you want to give a short summary of this bill, which is...
Madam Chair and members, many of you have heard this already, but it is a proposal for a dollar surcharge on a deer license for game and fish management that has a secondary benefit of providing food for the hungry. I know there is one test buyer in the audience, Ms. Wilkins, who has not addressed any of the committees yet and would like to speak. So if I could have her, she's made the trip. And
thank you very much for allowing me to testify. I'm Betty Wilkins. My husband and I have a farm halfway between Mora and Mille Lacs Lake. We're both hunters, but I come to you rather than as a hunter, although I do support this bill very much as a hunter. I would like to give you a little introduction to the present venison donation program we have and how that could be enhanced. And really, made come true by the passage of this bill. As you can clearly see, I'm for the bill. I did ask for a piece of paper that could be distributed to you on the three-year summary of the venison donation program. And I've helped coordinate this program since its inception in spring of 2004. And both on a local level and on a statewide level. And I do a lot of the speaking with the hunters and helping with organizations, particularly hunting organizations that want to develop this program, meat processors and such like that. I'm a volunteer. I'm old and have the luxury of being a volunteer. As you look through the figures, I think that you probably, it's pretty self-explanatory. There have been nearly 12,000 deer donated in 3 years. All of these, the donations last year were 30% of that total. The number of processors involved, you have to be certified to be by the MDA to be part of this process. A number of processors has remained constant or declining. The costs in this program the last 3 years have all been from volunteers and volunteer organizations. So this is truly a volunteer basis. We really find ourselves limited. Hunters are trying. Some hunters are paying the full cost. But we find the programs where organizations are bearing some of the costs or all of the costs in the few communities that have them, the hunters will go there. 89% of the deer donated last year were donated to free and low-cost programs. So we know that the hunters will respond if to programs that are either free or very low-cost. The location One of the problems with the program is we have, although we have 21 processors as of this last year, their locations across the state are, well, scattered. So there's a lot of areas that are not served by a processor. This bill, if passed, will provide a funding that will be continuous, and we need to rely on continuous funding that will allow for the result of having many more processors probably involved in the program, because right now it's a lot of work for them, and they are not getting paid very much. Some of them are volunteering a lot to be part of this program. And the hunters will continue remaining as the people who are really in charge of the program. Hunters initiated this program. They've been willing to pay for it. But the thing is, not everybody can be part of the program, because only those who have the extra money or the organization available to them, which is only in a few communities where the subsidizing is occurring, only those few areas can people be free to bring a deer to donate. It does have an impact on the population, even though only nearly 1,200 deer were taken. The majority of those are does, and does have the ability to reproduce, which means down the road a lot more than the number that you see have been impacted, the herd has been reduced by. So I think it's a great bill. It can make this program soar. It can make it be what we hoped it would be when we first started it 2 years ago. And I urge its passing.
Thank you for coming. Any questions? Thank you so much.
I'm sure I just wanted to note that both the Minnesota Deer Hunters Association and the Buffalo Whitetails have folks in the audience. The Buffalo Whitetails support it, the Minnesota Deer Hunters Association. So we're continuing to work with both the groups as we move through the process.
Would either of them like to testify? Yes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Tom Keller. I'm here representing the Minnesota Deer Hunters Association. I will be very brief. I think almost everybody in the room has more or less heard my story in regards to the Game and Fish Fund and the dollars going in and out of it. We don't oppose the program that Representative Hansen's proposing at all. We have a Hunters Against Hunger program in our own organization. We just oppose, obviously, the dollar surcharge, the mandatory dollar surcharge from the DOS.
If you would remind this committee what portion of the deer hunters you represent.
Certainly, Madam Chair. We have about 20,000 members. It fluctuates depending on what our annual renewal time is. We have 63 statewide chapters all over the state.
And out of how many licensees is that?
Madam Chair, there are a little over 500,000 deer hunters in the state, either firearms, archery, or muzzleloader. And some people buy more than one license, so roughly $500,000. 500,000 people, I'm sorry.
I can't do the math. I think that's 5%, but I can't do the math that quick. Thank you very much.
Yes, Madam Chair. Thank you.
Madam Chair and committee, my name is John Beck. I've been running a Farmers and Hunters Feeding the Hungry program in southeastern Minnesota for about 2 years now. I kind of wanted to get this thing going after spending 2 years trying to drum up donations to fund my program. I saw the opportunity to just for this program just to go wild is just pretty much based on funding. The first year I got started kind of late. I worked my butt off and I scraped up enough to have 12 deer processed. And next year I got about 4,000, which would cut up about 69. Like I say, the possibilities are limitless. We just have to have the funding available. And I just think it's just great. I mean, there's so many pros to the program and so few cons. I mean, a dollar a year. That's all I have. Thank you very much.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
I'd like to know membership information in relation to membership, number of deer hunters and state deer groups as well.
Okay. It also varies depending on the time of year, but we generally carry approximately 1,200.
Thank you.
And our group is pretty much southeastern zone 3.
Thank you very much for coming. Are there any questions for members? Representative
Mackinac. Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Hansen, I'm trying to remember. And was the motion for possible inclusion in the finance bill?
Yes.
And Madam Chair, I'm trying to understand, why would this not be a game and fish issue, and why would it be before this committee in this manner? Why wouldn't it be for possible? I'm not even, is it in Representative Bill's 1116 bill?
When there's financing involved, and there is in this bill, they will all be here.
McNamara, we moved it to this committee in the last committee stop, I think. You know, it was referred to this committee, referred to the finance committee with inclusion to here. That was the motion that was voted on, and I believe there was a roll call and vote taken. So.
Without further ado, we will lay House File 278 over for possible inclusion in the finance bill. I see Representative Dominguez is in here, and we will hear from him next. The hour is late, so we are going reasonably rapidly here.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
From his committee to the
I will move House File 1045, be recommended, and laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus. That is my why don't you tell us about it, then I'll make the motion for you.
Okay, Madam Chair, thank you for your time. I know we're running here. I'm at two other meetings, and I had a bill, so just heard a bill. This is the Metropolitan Council is requesting changes in Minnesota statute 297A.94 to clarify the distribution of lottery funds for regional parks and Minnesota statute 473.303 to provide per diem payments to the Metropolitan Parks and Open Space Commission's members. This bill also creates a nonprofit foundation to help fund regional parks. Madam Chair, I'm going to leave it at that and turn it over to my testifier, Duo Time.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members, and thank you, Representative Dominguez, for carrying this bill for us. My name is Judd Shetton, and I'm the Government Affairs Director for the Metropolitan Council, and I'll very briefly tell you what this legislation does. Article 1 of the bill would authorize the Council to create a private parks foundation to supplement public tax dollars for land acquisition and land preservation efforts. And in other states, there are similar foundations. What the bill would do in particular is that it would authorize the Council to provide up to $500,000 from its general fund to establish the foundation. And with that, the Council would prepare and submit to the legislature by January 2009 a report on the creation and the establishment of this foundation. Article 2 of the bill does two things that Representative Dominguez mentioned. Back in near 2000, legislation was passed that provided money to be used in lieu of the sales tax for environmental programs. And Section E of that statute requires that 22.5% of the lottery seats are to be spent on metropolitan parks and trails. The problem with it is that section did not define the metropolitan area. So all that we're doing here is asking that the language be changed to clearly define that the metropolitan area, what the metropolitan area is in that statute. And lastly, the Metropolitan Parks and Open Space Commission was created in 1974, and up until 2003, we provided per diem for the members of our Parks and Open Space Commission. We did away with that back in 2000, during the 2003 legislature. we have been asked by the Parks and Open Space Commission, and the council agrees that that we should be paying them per diem, and it'll be only for attending official Parks and Open Space Commission members. Prior to that, they were submitting per diem for things that weren't quite what we thought they should be submitting per diem for, and so now we are in agreement. We think that we should be paying them, and I appreciate your support. And Madam Chair, if the committee is interested in passing the bill, I do think that there may be a real minor amendment that has to go to this bill, just to clarify on page 5, section 2. I think we need to add application. I think we have to delete section 2 and add this act. And then on page 5, line 13, I think we say this act is, and that will be effective the day following the enactment. Because we added the Parks Foundation in the Representative Hill Streams Committee, the local government committee, and I think that the amendment that we put on that time, I didn't do it correctly. So I apologize, and we'd like to get to hear it.
The way I read the bill, it does not have another stop. Am I reading that correctly? Or do you see that it has another stop in the legislative process?
Madam Chair, and Representative Tingle said it could very well go to GovOps. I'll defer to Representative Tingle said, I know that it's a private and non-profit group, so I'm not sure if that's a legislative group or not, but I know that House Rules 4.13 say that if there are any things that deal with advisory boards or things, that it could go to government operations, and I would have no problem with that either. But I'm not sure if it does have to go there.
But you have not talked to me.
Madam Chair, I have not talked to Chair Kowalski.
I also think it does need to come back here. So let us. Does council have the amendment?
I don't have the amendment.
Would you like to try that again?
Yep, I actually have it right here.
First of all, we will then have to, and I will do this for you. House File 1045 that be recommended to pass. It's going to have to be sent to the Finance Committee from here.
No. Madam Chair and members, the $500,000 that would be raised for this comes from the Council's General Fund, so there will be no state dollars.
I understand that, but does anybody have any good advice for me on this one? We are thinking it has to go to both GovOp and finance taxes, but it will go back through finance. So what we will do right now is I will move House File 1045 and be recommended to pass and sent to finance, in which case they will make a determination about which committee it needs to go to next, but now we are open for an amendment.
Madam Chair, I gave Mr. Helen the amendment, so hopefully it was.
I gave the amendment. I'll repeat it. On page 5, line 10, delete section 2 and insert this act. And on line 13, delete sections 1, 2, 3, R and insert this act is.
Madam Chair, I'll move you now.
Thank you. Representative Hackbarth moves the amendment. I don't see any questions. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposition? Amendment is adopted. Are there any questions on the bill before we move it on?
Ms. Thank you, Ms. Chair. And for Mr. Shetland, I was just kind of curious because the lottery in lieu of sales tax is part of the current funding for Metropolitan Regional. Yeah. So how would this affect that? Would that remain the same? Or could you explain that just a little bit?
Madam Chair and Representative, it wouldn't affect that at all. It's still that same amount will go there. All we're doing is defining what the metropolitan area is when it says that 22.5% has to go to the Metropolitan Regional Park System, that we're just stating that it's part of the, that it's the seven county metropolitan area. That's it. It's very simple.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Mr. Shetland, are you concerned that it's going to meet all the deadlines if it has to go to finance and then the sub-ops? Are you thinking to make it all work?
Madam Chair and Representative Hackbarth, I think, you know, if it goes to finance, that's fine. I would appreciate it if the committee would consider putting it in their omnibus bill as well, even as we go along this process. I'm not quite sure when you have to have your bill out, but
Madam Chair and Judge, if it doesn't all work out, give me the amendment, then we'll consider that at that time when we're putting the bill together.
I think if you do not have to go to governor office, you will have be fine. So,
right.
No, they may have to pay taxes, so they need to check on that. That decision can be made in finance, and you will. I do not think you will miss the deadline given that.
Madam Chair, I just think it's something we need to do, and I just want to make it all work before the deadline.
Yep. And Madam Chair and members, as far as the tax implication of this bill, we're not changing any of the lottery and loot tax. All we're doing is adding a definition of what the metropolitan area is. So it's purely policy. We went to the local government committee, handled it there. We're here because it has to deal with metropolitan parks. So I don't think that there's any way in the world that taxes need to change. So, but I appreciate words, Representative Hackbarth and committee. I think this is a good bill, and I appreciate your support.
Members have heard the motion.
Madam Chair.
Yes. Representative Pinkleton.
A couple of quick things. Thank you, Madam Chair. In regards to the deadline issue, you know, there's still the option to have gone back through rules. So, you know, I think there's some possibilities there. I just have a question with page one where, you know, it talks about authorizing the creation of a nonprofit foundation. So, Mr. Shetland, is the Metropolitan Council, do they have any other foundations under your organization?
Madam Chair and Representative Singleton, we do not. We do not. What we're trying to do with this bill, and I know as Chair of the LCCMR, that you were very aware of the fact that when land becomes available for the park system, we'd like to be able to move very quickly to be able to take that land. And what this will allow us to do is through private dollars go in and grab that land, which is already recognized as part of our regional park system. So it's really another tool for the council to go ahead and do this, or for this private nonprofit to do that. And I think it'd be a big benefit to the regional park system. And I guess that's about it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
With that, members, all those in favor of returning the ask and the return to the committee on finance, say aye.
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 Any opposition?
Thank you, Madam Chair, members.
Representative Solberg is not here to meet with Representative Ansel. I think we're going to have to track him down, one of them down in a little bit. Is Representative Egan is here? Would you like to? Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would like to move the House File 1666 be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. And what this bill does, it provides $475,000 to fund studies and other activities related to terrestrial and geologic carbon sequestration, storing carbon in plants and soils, and also studying the possibility of storing carbon in deep geologic formations. We need to determine whether future storage of CO2 in Minnesota can be feasible or might be feasible, especially given the current direction that not only the state but the nation's been moving in regard to the greenhouse gases. This will provide, a study that will look at the broad climate, environmental, and economic benefits. The information will be valuable in guiding future policy decisions as far as both public and private investments in sequestration, making sure that we are moving in the right direction and making the investments wisely in this area. I look at sequestration in Minnesota forests, in ag lands, wetlands, and in prairies, and analyze the public and private programs that are being proposed, and also develop recommendations for the legislature in this area on future policy needs. It is coordinated through the Minnesota Terrestrial Carbon Sequestration Initiative, which is a task force of government, stakeholder, and university representatives. It's based out of the University of Minnesota. It also provides a preliminary study for Minnesota by the Minnesota Geologic Survey. It looked again at the possibility of carbon capture and sequestration. In the southeast part of Minnesota, there's some potential there, and they'll be studying that area of the state. With that, I do have with me today Mr. Bill Grant, who will testify to the bill.
Madam Chair and members, again, Bill Grant for the Isaac Walton League, and I am a member of the Minnesota Terrestrial Carbon Sequestration Initiative at the university. You're getting a handout on the initiative now. This bill proposes work really in two areas, as Representative Eakin suggested. The first is looking at terrestrial carbon sequestration, starting with an inventory of all of the types of lands in Minnesota that are potentially useful for carbon sequestration activities, then quantifying the availability of and the ability of various land use practices to sequester carbon and in what amounts, then identifying a network of potential monitoring sites for demonstration projects that could be hosted around the state. Not funding those demonstration projects at this point, but identifying where the best sites would be, and then evaluating what kind of protocols we would need to use to determine exactly how much carbon could be sequestered from those activities. The dollars also fund the ongoing work of the Terrestrial Carbon Sequestration Initiative, which is a project of the Initiative for Renewable Energy and the Environment, IRE, at the university. The second part of the bill sends a small amount of money to the State Geologic Survey to begin looking at whether or not Minnesota has the type of geology that could be suitable for deep underground storage of CO2. And there is an area along the Minnesota-Wisconsin border, roughly between Duluth and the Twin Cities, known as the Mid-Continent Rift, which geologists believe is similar to the type of geology, very porous limestone geology, rather sandstone geology, that could be suitable for this type of deep underground sequestration. This study is at the Geologic Survey is only going to be a paper study to determine whether or not we want to take the next step of actually drilling holes in the ground to see whether or not that geology is in fact suitable. So this is really a first step along that road. So with that, Madam Chair, I'd be happy to take any questions that members might have.
Members? I don't see any questions. Representative Eakin will renew his motion. And House File 1666 will be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. Thank you all.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative McNamara?
You know, ma'am, I'm going to be here for the whole hearing, so if anyone else, I think Representative Barnes might have a different opinion, so it doesn't matter if you're not here.
Well, then, let's ask Representative Anzo,
sure,
if he can do actually two. If you can start with, you can start with your own bill, but then we will ask you if you will do the one that you and Representative Chip also want to do together. We'll bring it up and see if that works.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. This is House File 631. It is the department's forestry bill. With me is Mr. Tomlinson, a familiar face. I'll go through the bill. To begin with, if you would look at sections 5 and 6, we amended those two sections out of this bill in the last committee, in the policy committee, so that sections 1, 2, 3, 4, 7, and 8 are what remain. Sections 1, 2, 3, and 4 take existing accounts and merge them, including federal revenue, and create forest resource assessment products and services account. Three accounts become one account. And this is for services to be provided to the Forest Service, Bowser, county units of government, and services to be provided include survey, data collection, and aerial photography, to name but a few. Section 8 is necessary to repeal the sunset provision in the critical effort, which is the Sustainable Forest Resources Act and the Forest Resources Council, which is a 17-person appointed body appointed by the governor, responsible for advising land management organizations and others for developing sustainable forest products, policies, and research. And it is in that section where we are recommending the governor's recommendation for funding, which is $1.18 million in FY08 and $780,000 in FY09 to continue this critical program. I'd ask Mr. Tomlinson to talk about another section of the bill.
That was actually section... Bob Tomlinson with DNR Division of Forestry, for the record. Madam Chair, members of the committee, what Representative Angela just explained with the Forest Resources Council, that is Section 10. In fact, Section 8 would be the change in security provision that was introduced on behalf of forest industry, which basically allows those folks that have 100% security down to go back to the 15% cash down if they choose to do so. And we testified previously that we're okay with that, that there would be no fiscal impact to the U.S. relative to that. And in Section 9 of the bill, is that part that was, I think, we brought to on behalf of the Laurentian folks, and specifically in item C under subdivision 1, it talks about, it gives them more flexibility of how to sell timber, where they can now sell it on a appraised value approach as well as the scaled value, which they currently do. Currently, there's a few counties that do not feel that they have the authority to do it that way. This one has to do that. The same flexibility that the state is doing.
Madam Chair, thank you, Mr. Tomlinson. Just to remind committee members, what Mr. Tomlinson was just explaining has to do with the two biomass facilities recently going online in the community today and Virginia.
So we'll make a motion on the floor that Senator Hills will refer to that. Other
questions from members? I don't see any questions. Representative Anfield, would you want to renew your motion? I'm not sure you made a motion. Did you make a motion?
I did not, and I'd be happy to move that House File 631 be
laid over
for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.
File. 6:31 will be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. Right. There is another bill that you and Representative Solberg are doing together, and I don't know whether you have a copy of that bill and can take care of that for him or not.
Madam Chair and members, this is House File 1035. I wish I knew more about it. I should know more about it. I'll give it my best attempt. This is an exchange of tax forfeited land in Itasca County between Blandon Paper Company and Itasca County involving the, and I just have reinforcements that arrived. Thank you, Mr. George. Having to do with the Minnesota Steel Industries project that is currently being permitted. And with that, I'll turn it over to Mr. George.
Thank you, Madam Chair members. My name is Jim Girard, and I'm with Cookville Girard Associates here representing Minnesota Steel. The bill has been through several committees. I think some of you have seen it before. It's fairly simple. The Section 1, if you remember last year, there was a land exchange in Itasca County, and part of that land exchange, Minnesota Steel purchased title insurance to help speed the process up. And this simply, normally the state would have to pay for that through the state. Because they purchased it privately, this simply says they don't have to pay for the same thing twice. And second part is, the state limits counties to 10-year leases, and in order to finance this project, the second part would simply say that Itasca County can lease to Minnesota Steel for 20 years for the buffer and some of the tailings. And that's essentially the bill.
Representative Anfeld, would you like to make a motion here?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would move House File 1035 be added to the list for possible inclusion in the Omnibus Environment Natural Resources.
House File 1035 is going to be laid over for possible inclusion in the Omnibus Bill. Representative McNamara, you are now off.
Well, Madam Chair, and I'm wondering if I was too mature. I wasn't very sensitive to both the DNR and University of Minnesota, which are in the audience, and probably only for mine, and I could probably do it real quick to allow them to get a little sleep if that would be okay. So
I'll carry down my questions to 10.
Madam Chair, I believe the recommendation is to move it
for possible inclusion.
Is that the motion, Madam Chair?
Mm-hmm. If you'd like to make that
I'd like to make a motion to move House File 632 for possible inclusion in the Omnibus Finance Bill.
Would
you like to go ahead? Well, Madam Chair, this is, and we do have... there is a packet of information if the page wants to pass it out on the Umore property, but it is possible, Madam Chair. I'm not sure. There probably are some members that haven't seen this before.
I think there's some new members that haven't seen this.
Mr. Sink, I believe, has in the cardboard box there some information about Umore. Madam Chair and members, this is the land... located right alongside Representative Osmond's, where Representative Osmond lives, right alongside the Umore Park in Empire Township in rural Dakota County. It's part of the University of Minnesota football on-campus stadium project that we did last year in session. And this is some clarifying language that relates to the agreement that the University of Minnesota DNR
and Dakota County in a non-voting manner, which has a non-voting participant of the three partners. And Madam Chair, maybe what I'll do is actually allow members, I know you have a really full agenda, and so the members that haven't heard this, I could just feel free to ask questions, and if they want to, because I believe you are right, there's at least two or three members here that maybe have not seen this before.
I think we would want to talk about Section B in particular, because that you are, that's one of the finance issues here.
Madam Chair, did you refer, if you could repeat, I thought you said Section 8?
E, on the back side, 2.20.
I did two of the
paragraph E, I'm sorry, paragraph.
Oh, okay. Madam Chair, and this was, I wanted to clarify and put this in the bill because it was part of the discussion between myself, the conference committee members, DNR, and the University of Minnesota, that the land of the, it's the leased land in this area, be kept in a separate account, and that money be used, Madam Chair, for the development in this area. In other words, there's about 1,000 agricultural acres being leased out for private farms currently, and if I just use $100, that's $100,000 of rent income on this property currently. And it was my suggestion that that money absolutely stay in a separate fund and be used within the area for maintenance of the area and or development planning, things like that. So they are using it to maintain the roads, to allow farm commodities to reach market, and then it is available for other uses, and it is being kept in a separate account. And I know the university is here, or Mr. Kosinka from the DNR is here that can confirm that.
Madam Chair and Representatives, my name is Joe Kosinka. I'm with the Department of Natural Resources. I am the Regional Director for DNR Central Region. Yes, these are dollars that come in from lease agreements that the university has had in the past and continues to have with a number of, as Representative McNamara said, farmers in the area. There are agricultural leases. There is a lease with a storage company out there. There is a lease with Minnesota Public Radio. There's a radio tower. There is a gun club lease there. Lease revenues amount to just over $80,000 a year. And they have always been part of the administration, operation, and management of that piece of land. And as the law was created last year that is shifting that land over to the state of Minnesota over the course of 20 years, but has set up for immediate management by both the university, the state, and Representative McNamara said we're bringing in Dakota County into this. It was requested in the law last year that that money be made available to the ongoing management of that's being done by the three entities.
I am assuming that you intend that the money go into the account and be appropriated out by the legislature each biennium.
Madam Chairman, Todd Iverson, representing the University of Minnesota. These are actually leases that are held by the university as we maintain ownership of this land until the agreement is fully implemented at the end of the 20 years. And we have and will continue to hold these leases in a separate account within our budget and see that they are administered in this 2,800-acre area that is in joint agreement. So money does not come to the state. It stays within, at least for the next 20 years, it will stay within the university budget. The leases are as we are the ultimate owner of the land at this point, they come to the university, we keep it in a separate account there, and then the money is spent out back on that acreage.
Any questions for members? Would you like to renew your motion?
Madam Chair, I would like to renew my motion that House File House File 633 be laid over for possible inclusion in the Natural Resources Finance Bill.
House File 632 is laid over for possible inclusion.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members.
Representative Yornis, are you prepared that we're going to shuffle people again here the way it looks?
Mr. Chair?
Yes. Representative Scalzi.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would move House File 152 for consideration and possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.
Thank you, Representative Scalzi. Representative Norris, is this doesn't need to go anywhere else after
I don't think so,
as far as you know.
We're either
that sounds good to me or
okay.
Or worse than
yes.
And please proceed.
Yeah. Well, thank you very much. Appreciate the opportunity to again present my bill to some of you have heard this before who were in the policy committee. I'm here representing the senior citizens of Minnesota. For many years, Minnesota was very, very generous and gave senior citizens a free fishing license. And then a couple of years ago, the decision was made to do away with that, and everybody paid the same, regardless of age. Well, some constituents approached me prior to the session and asked if maybe we could revisit that, and I said I would consider that. That has resulted in this legislation, which, as you see, is very short. After struggling, as many of you have, to read a lot of bills, this is an easy one. And I'm not talking about a free license anymore. I'm not talking about a discount for 65-year-olds anymore. 65-year-olds anymore. We're now looking at 70-year-olds, and they would get a half-price license. And that's really what the bill is. So it's a half-price deal if you're 70 and over and like to fish in Minnesota. That's the only change. And I don't have an updated fiscal note. I don't know if the committee members do or not. The original one was based on 865. And since the amendment that moved it to 70, again, I have not seen any update on that. And we could perhaps get it for you as you consider your bill.
Members, I just checked before the meeting began, and that note is still in process. But if this intention is to lay this over, we will have that before the omnibus bill is completed.
It will be considerably less than the 65 because there are just that many fewer fishing at 870.
It should not be a problem as long as we're going to lay it over.
That's right. So that, members, is my story, and I'm going to stick to it.
Members, are there any questions? I have one quick story that I have to tell you. My father, who passed away last fall, was for several years the oldest licensed fisherman in North America.
See, from
when he turned 100, he went to get his fishing license, the same way we all do, through the electronic means, and it would not accept it at the local dealer. And so the local dealer called to the DNR, and they said, well, it must be free when you're 100. And so they gave him his license. 2 weeks later, in the mail, came an envelope which said, you owe us $27.
Oh, really? Was your father from Glenwood?
Yeah.
Okay. I hadn't heard that story, but I'd heard of him. He was a pretty famous fisherman.
Yeah. I hope to catch
a fraction of that many fish.
Yeah.
Well, we hope to have grandpas taking in teaching their grandchildren how to fish. I know many senior citizens that will thank you for this, Bill. Yeah. Anyone in the audience want to testify as? If not, we will lay this over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
Representative Demmer, welcome.
Mr. Chair.
And Representative, is this also for inclusion in the omnibus bill only?
What are my options?
the options seem to be yes up here. So I will move that House File 325 be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.
Thank you.
To the bill.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, House File 325 is a bill that's about one of our big lakes down in South Central Minnesota, or Southeast and Northwest, or up in the Homestead County and in Wapishaw County, Lake Zumbro. Lake Zumbro was formed by a dam that was constructed a little over 100 years ago on the lake to provide some electricity back into the Rochester area. And over the last 100 years, that lake members has been silting in. On the south end of the lake where the rivers come in to form it, we basically have pathways now. And so some citizens from down there have been working the last number of years. They've been putting in their personal cash. They raised $30,000 locally and been putting in a huge amount of time to get the lake all mapped up topographically, to know what it looks like, to know where the bad spots are. And, Mr. Chair, what this is about now is getting started with the process of dredging that lake out and getting it back to its condition that it was. What I'd like to do is introduce Mr. Bill Angerman. He's an engineer and lives in the area, and he spent a lot of his time, and I think probably benefited by some adult beverage in the evenings occasionally, is what I'm going to guess. But he's an engineer and is going to go through, we have a PowerPoint on paper that's been in your packets, members, and he'll go through that and walk you through what they've been doing and what the lake looks like.
Thank you, Representative. Has everyone found us? Mr. Angerman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. As Mr. Demmer said, my name is Bill Angerman. I'm the board of directors of Lake Zumbro Forever. My day job is I'm the director of water and wastewater services for a consulting firm in Rochester. So with that said, what we'd like to do tonight is just kind of run you through our PowerPoint presentation that you have on paper and give you a little background about the lake itself. I'll tell you a little bit about it and kind of what we have in mind. So first off, just a little bit about the lake. The lake is about 650 acres, about 5 miles long. It is the only recreational lake in southeast Minnesota, basically east of Faribault and west of Lake Pepin. Lake Zumbro, as Representative Demmer said, was formed when Rochester constructed a hydropower dam. And kind of the key item on the second slide there is that it has the highest population relative to recreational lake area in all of Greater Minnesota. So it does see a high usage, and it's very important to our region. Next slide, they're just kind of showing the various public sites on the lake. There is three restaurants, there's a Christian camp, a campground. DNR has a public launch on the lake, as does Olmsted County. We estimate that on a peak day in the summer, there's 1,600 people using the lake. What we've been told is this kind of usage only rivals Lake Minnetonka in the whole state of Minnesota. So again, just wanted to stress the importance of the lake. In the next slide there, just some of the areas where we're kind of at in the state. Within 15 miles of the lake are, you know, Rochester, towns like Byron, Plainview, Zumbrota, you know, so a lot of towns in our area. A little bit about the dam. That next slide there, that's a picture of the dam. It was added to the National Historic Register in 1991. It is approximately a 3-megawatt facility. So Rochester Public Utilities does operate and maintain that. Back in, I believe, 98-99, they did go through the dam safety program, and they did do a lot of improvements to the dam to make sure, you know, continued long life, you know, and the ability to produce, you know, what I guess we'll call green power for the area. Switching to the next page, I'm sorry, I'm going to kind of go through these quickly. So, next picture, a bunch of fish there in the upper left-hand corner. Lake Zumbro is an excellent fishery. It's a real good panfish lake, Bass Lake. It is one of only two lakes south of the metro that are managed for muskies. So it's managed for muskies as well as French Lake and Faribault. Upper right-hand corner, this is some of the fisheries biologists' work that they're doing on the lake. Lower left-hand corner, that guy holding that big fish. That's a northern. That's a 42.5-inch northern. That's actually me holding that fish. So I'd like to point that out to everybody. Secondly, just a little bit about that picture. I'm wearing rain gear and waders, and it's 65 degrees and sunny out. The reason is, like, the B&R guys, when you know, I went out with them, they said, make sure you wear waders and rain gear. I said, well, how come? They said, we don't understand. Well, those fish, you know, have been in a big pen, you know, trapped in that, and they're all fresh and lively, so you've got to hold on to them for everything you get, so you get slime all over you. So that's the reason for the waders, the raincoats. So, next slide there. Didn't come out real well, but what those numbers are is that's Secchi disk reading, so that's lake water clarity plotted versus time. So as you go to the lower right, you can see the water clarity is really rather excellent in the lake. It's really been improving. And part of that we attribute to, you know, farming practices, some of the construction practices in Rochester really have been having an effect on our lake water clarity. Unfortunately, on there is a blue line that's on there that you can't see, and that represents 3 feet. And what we call that is one centum. And Senator Senjum's in the back. That's something that he coined. And that's when he can see his toes at his knees. That's 3 feet. So using Senator Senjum's terms, last year we actually had 5 centums we could measure, 15 feet on the north end of our lake. So. We, by the way, we use that with his permission, so I wouldn't say otherwise. So, next slide there is a series of 4 maps. One of the things that we realized as we were moving forward as a volunteer effort that we really needed data. And that's partly why, you know, plus you put an engineer on the committee and that's kind of what happens too. So we didn't have any data from 1978 on, so what we did through the assistance of Rochester Public Utilities is we purchased a GPS sonar unit, and we literally, actually one of our members literally crisscrossed the lake in his pontoon, and we did our own bathymetry study on the lake. And with that then, we were able to extrapolate sedimentation rates, what's going on, historically what's been happening in the lake. And what we found is that since the inception of the lake in 1919, the lake has lost about 3 billion gallons of water, about 50% of its capacity. So that's the negative. The good thing is, though, that from 1919 to 1957, that's when we lost almost all the volume. From 57 on to now, we've only lost about 0.4 billion gallons of water. So what that means is that the things that have been going on in the watershed, as far as the various farm programs, again, the construction programs have really had an impact, and we're really seeing diminished sedimentation in the lake. Therefore, you know, one of the things that we want to make sure, if we're going to spend our time, our money, and potentially taxpayer money, we want to make sure the lake isn't going to fill back in. So this went a long way in helping us understand that. Then in the lower right-hand corner, it's just graphically, you know, illustrating that same concept. Flipping on the next page, sediment deposition rates. This is just, again, graph. One of the key things there is that independent of Lake Zumbro Forever, Watershed Partnership was formed 2 years ago. And that Watershed Partnership is working in the watershed, which encompasses, I believe, 6 counties. And their goal is to further reduce sedimentation by 30%. And again, that's a key component here, that if we're looking at cleaning up a lake, we've got to make sure the sediment doesn't get back into the lake. So that's a real important parallel effort to what we're doing. Next picture there is the actual dredging of a lake is governed or regulated by the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency. So again, to make sure that we knew this was a viable project, as Representative Demmer mentioned, we raised $30,000 locally, and we contracted with Barr Engineering to assess the sediment in the lake. And what we found is that the sediment would be classified as a Tier 2 sediment. There's 3 classifications. Tier 2 sediment is satisfactory for land disposal. So that was really good for us, in that we didn't, you know, mercury and pesticides and lead, you know, some of the things you're really worried about when you're cleaning the lake out were not present. Only 2 items, arsenic and copper, were found above the minimum thresholds, where we would have been just unregulated altogether. So that was real positive. So we felt that this project, you know, from that perspective then, was viable. Then the real issue is then financing. Last slide there, supported by Lake Sunbrew Improvement Association, our group, Olmsted County and Wabasha County, that both passed motions or resolutions of support. Rochester Public Utilities has also done the same. In your packet, I believe there are some of those letters of support. And then lastly, the Zumbro Watershed Partnership. With that, that's kind of the conclusion of our PowerPoint. Randy, I'm not sure if you want me to introduce Judy or if you were going to.
Mr. Chair, if we could, we have a couple more people that can just very short brief comments.
Certainly.
We'll start out with Dean Elverson. Dean is with the Lake Zumbro Forever. I'm going to be a resident.
Mr. Chair.
Dean, yes, sir.
Welcome, Mr. Elverson.
Thank you. About 4 years ago, I moved on to the lake, and about that same time, you'll meet someone named Judy Oley in a few minutes to talk a little bit about where she got started in this whole project. So it's been about a four and a half year project that we're into. I entered the picture 2 years ago, exactly in March, and we formed a committee of 12 representatives from the community around the lake, and we have put together plans to deal with the restoration of the lake. And we've worked very closely with everyone that we can find that has a stake in this. The result of all this is this packet item that you have. And it's a management plan that is started first that talks about what it is exactly that we plan to do. And then the next part is the Lake Zumbro Forever Project Scope. And that piece is intended to describe exactly what we would use the $350,000 to make the plan for this project. And then included in the packet beyond that is a Zumbro Watershed Partnership letter of support. And then we also have an important letter, RPU, Rochester Public Utilities, has done some matching funds with us to make sure the energy is still available from the lake after we're done. As a matter of fact, I spoke to Joe Hensel the other day, and he just said that it's his hope he can increase the capacity. It will not decrease. And finally, we have a letter of support from the Wabasha County Board indicating that they feel that this is going to be a great project. The other piece that really sums up the whole thing is this brochure here. So if you want to save anything that's really concise, this is it. It talks about where we come from, what we've done. All of the work has been volunteer. We've raised money locally to do some assessment of the soil in there, the sediment. And we have done about $60,000 worth of in-kind work on our part so far. And so we are in the process right now through this bill of finding planning money that would lead, hopefully, to bonding money in 08. And at that point, that's the end of my comments, except for questions later.
Mr. Chair, if we could, we have Judy Oley. She's an Office of Fund Commissioner that represents that area of the county.
Welcome, Ms. Oley.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Judy Oley, and I'm here not only as a county commissioner today, but also as the original chair of the Zumbro Watershed Partnership. Well, that organization was formed originally about 4 years ago. We started meeting and talking about the needs of this watershed, and we realized that we needed to form an organization that would look out for the best interests of this area, this watershed. And I'm sure you're probably wondering at this point, what are we doing to reduce sediment in the future so that when this project is done, it doesn't go back in? And we do have a few things that are happening. We were able to get a planning grant to reduce turbidity or sediment and increase and improve aquatic habitat in the watershed. So this planning grant has been going on for 18 months. It will end on July 30th, and we'll have a scoping document at that point that will address how we plan to reduce sediment in the Zumbro watershed. In addition to that, we applied for an EPA grant It's been approved at the state level, and now it's at the federal level. And it's a five-year fund implementation grant. So that's going to take us through to achieve the goal of the planning grants. Now, in addition to that, the MPCA just started a TMDL study in the Zumbro Watershed Partnership with turbidity on the streams. So we've got a lot of energy that's being directed to the issues that of the turbidity or the sediment in the watershed. So I'll be here for questions if you have any.
I have one quick question for my own curiosity from previous studies. I'm not sure who would be the best one. The arsenic in the water, was it natural or was it from farming practices in the 30s, killing off whatever? Do you have any idea in this case?
Thank you, Chair. Bill Angerman. Best we can tell, it's natural occurring, but we don't really know the source of it. Because it was so barely over the threshold, that's kind of our estimate on that.
Thank you. I'm just trying to compare with some other areas in the state. Any questions from any of the members?
Yes.
Representative Bosmond.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Because the dam is there to generate power, power is there to provide electricity to the city of Rochester, and they're collecting from the ratepayers, how much are they contributing to take care of this problem?
Sure.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Osmond, at this time we've just received support from them. They've been providing matching dollars as far as continuing on, as far as what anything locally would be from either Wabasha County, Olmsted County, or RPU has not been determined at this time.
Did you understand?
Other questions from members?
Mr. Chair, if I could, we also have a couple other people here. We have a Wabasha County Commissioner here, Don Springer, and we also have Terry Lee, who is an Olmsted County Water Planner, and Ron Fuller, who is a board member also of the Zumbro Watershed Partnership. And they're not going to testify today, but they are here in case there are questions and to show their support for the Fresno Maritime County Project and the Watershed Project.
Thank you. Any other questions? Anyone in the audience have questions? Or would like to speak for or against this project? Hearing none, we will lay House File 325 over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. Thank you all for your testimony. Thank you, Representative. And thank all those people who sent all those good emails to us.
They're learning this weekend.
They were good emails. Better than some.
I move that we lay over House File 516 for possible improvement.
Thank you. Representative Cornish, we are more than glad to see you, especially since this is the last bill on our agenda for the evening. Welcome to the committee, and we have a motion to lay it over, so proceed to your bill.
Mr. Chairman and members, I think we'll actually be fairly quick. If you look into your packets, you'll find the picture of this dam. In a minute, I'll turn it over to the Public Works Director, Al Forsberg, here to tell you more about it. But basically, this dam was built in 1911. And it encompasses a huge watershed of 21,000 square miles, and it's about 12 miles upstream of the Mankato, where it conjoins this on the Blue Earth River, and where it joins the Minnesota River about 12 miles downstream at Mankato. What we've been doing is in the county, as he'll tell you more about it, is we'd like to engage in a study and to find out the feasibility of either removal or refurbishment. And Mr. Forsberg will tell you more about this three organizations that want to take part in the study.
Forsberg.
Just a little general information on the dam. As Representative Cornish indicated, the dam is located about 12 miles south of Mankato. It's a hollow, reinforced concrete Amberson-type dam founded on sandstone in a U-shaped valley. A very beautiful setting, really, if you get a chance to visit. But the drainage area is about 2,400 square miles. The reservoir area about 318 acres, 6 miles long. The reservoir is nearly full of sediment. Taken soundings and roads are about 12 million cubic yards of slightly contaminated sediment in the reservoir. Essentially, it's a river flowing on top of this sediment to the dam and then down over the spillway or through the powerhouse. It's constructed in 1910 by a private company to generate electricity. In 1965, there was a large flood when NSP was operating the facility that wiped out the tanker gates and the electrical equipment was then removed. The dam was retrofitted with new gates and new electrical equipment in 1984. It has a peak generating capacity of about 5 or a little over 5 megawatts, which is enough to power a city of about 2,000 people with renewable energy. The dam and reservoir is owned by Blue Earth County. As I mentioned, the electrical generating equipment is owned and operated by North American Hydro, a private business. The condition of the dam is an old, very old dam, and it does have some problems and some deterioration. In 2002, emergency repairs were done to the foundation of the dam, where the water going over the spillway had curled and carried enough energy to erode away the foundation under the dam. The county, working with the Army Corps of Engineers, did about $1.3 million in emergency repairs. In 2003, the apron, the concrete apron below that spillway, which protects the foundation from erosion, broke up and the slab started moving about, and the county repaired that under an emergency contract of about $600,000. The bridge deck on the dam was in very poor condition and a safety hazard. We are in the process of replacing the bridge deck and doing some concrete repairs on it. The county has done or participated in several studies over the last several years on what to do with the old structure. In March of 1997, the county did an evaluation of alternatives at a very limited level of detail, looking at a number of alternatives, including removal and repair and partial removal, constructing a new dam. We did a detailed feasibility study of removing the dam in January of 2000, a detailed study on the feasibility of repairing it in 2002, and recently the Army Corps of Engineers completed a lower Minnesota River Basin study looking at a number of water resource opportunities and problems in the lower Minnesota River Valley, including the Rapidan Dam. What each of these studies has found is that to renovate the dam and put it into a condition where it would have 50 or 100 years of life ahead of it, essentially make it into a new structure, or like a new structure, would cost about $8 to $10 million. To remove the dam, and largely because of the huge amount of sediment behind it, this 12 million cubic yards of sediment, would cost anywhere $20 million. The county is requesting that the Corps develop a detailed feasibility study of both removal and repair of the dam for two reasons. One, that would give us some better information with which to deal with this problem. And secondly, it's really the only pathway to getting significant amounts of federal funds to help us with either that repair or removal option. While we do that, the county has not made a decision on whether to remove it or to repair it. What we are doing is doing our darndest and our best to keep it in a safe operating condition while we pursue those options. In addition to the power and the economic aspects, the dam has significant historic, recreation, and environmental implications. It's quite a feature in southern Minnesota. The study, the Corps of Engineers feasibility study, would have an overall study purpose to examine the economic and the environmental and the social feasibility of future options for the dam, including do nothing, rehabbing it, and removal. The first stage of the study would be to look at the hydrology and the hydraulics items. And essentially what that is how much water falls in the watershed, how fast does it flow at the dam, and then the hydraulics of the water going over the dam in the spillway, what kind of a spillway structure would you need to keep a safe structure, stable structure there. The other main task would be the geotechnical aspects, where we would do borings inside the dam, in the powerhouse, on both abutments, take samples, look at their erodibility, and try to get a better handle on the pressures involved and the stability of that foundation. This would be a partnership study, whereas federal government, through the Army Corps of Engineers, has set aside $79,000 in study funds. Blue Earth County would provide $60,000, and with this bill, the state of Minnesota would provide $60,000 for a total $199,000 in study funds for this first stage of study.
Mr. Chair, just a few more comments. I've lived in Fish and swam around this dam my whole life, lived near it, and just some informal non-scientific comments. The thing seems to be solid and hasn't moved over, what, an inch? But they put reference points and use GPS or and survey instruments, and it seems to be solid. And then with the concrete reinforcement they've done and more soundings to come, we're hoping that it's remaining solid as a rock. It's hugely popular around the local area. People want to keep it. They signed thousands of signatures on a petition once it had been delivered up to the governor to keep the dam. I believe from talking to the county commissioners overall, they really would like to keep it. The nice thing about this study, it's only costing us, which it's a lot of money, but it's $60,000 to find out if you want to spend $8 to renovate it or $20 million to get rid of it. Getting rid of it, even by the Corps' own estimation, is no guarantee all that contaminated sediment above it, if they do get rid of it, a dewatering process won't come down into the ecological system beneath the dam. So it seems to behoove us to keep it if possible, and hopefully that study will bear that out. And the $60,000, if you're asking, you know, why didn't the county put it up, I think it's a kind of a fairness issue. We've over doubled, almost tripled of what the state has spent on it. And the county is trying to save money as much as they can. If the decision is made to renovate or remove it, they're going to have a huge cost. And so we're just looking for some help on one of the three parts of the study for the $60,000. And hopefully, I think once, the good thing about the first phase of the study is they're studying the basic core and the foundation of the dam. And if that shows to be in good shape, then they probably wouldn't really need to go through a lengthy study. Then they could probably make the decision on whether to refurbish or remove it at that time. That sound right?
That is the most critical thing, the hydraulics and the geotechnical aspect.
And then if you're, what we're doing in the large picture, and we're not talking about coming back here for bonding money for this, but just to let you know what we're planning, is there's a new bridge is being put across the top of it for travel. We hope to get the bike trail that's almost finished to it on the top of that hill coming down and right across the top of the dam. The old county road used to run right across the dam. There's been a new one built. In that bottom picture, you'll see the new road above the dam. But the old road used to go right across the top of the dam for single traffic, and then we'd go up a windy gravel road. Hopefully that old road system is bringing a bike trail down. Beneath this dam, down along this side of it, as you look at it, you follow about a mile down, there's a beautiful camping area and a county park that they've put. So with the bike trail and the park and all the aesthetics around it, we hope to make it a real crown jewel. We'd just like some help with the study to get that far.
Representative Guthrie has a question or comment.
Mr. Chairman, I don't think they quite told you the whole story yet. You know, and their last legislator that represented that, they didn't have nearly the problems they do now. But on top of that, one of the greatest places to go for a piece of pie there is in the state of Minnesota is the dam store. And this grandma makes about 11, 12, 14 pies a day. And they are they're worth the trip from here to get
them. Sounds like a good field trip for this committee.
I think it should. Bring your fishing pole.
Representative Osman.
Mr. Chairman, it is the best dam store by a dam site.
That's their theme, right? Piece of work. You can walk right through the hollow for the dam from one end to the other. You look under the gate, you can see beaver and muskrats and come and fish and everything else. It's quite a sight to see.
Yeah.
Mr. Chair.
I do have a serious question.
Ask you a serious question, Representative Bosman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Cornish. As I was looking at the document, it's indicating that there's some revenues that are generated by the electricity that's produced there. And where are those revenues currently going? It says $120,000 per year.
The Chair, Representative, the hydroelectric generation facilities is owned by North American Hydro. The county has an agreement with them, and we receive about $20,000 per year, meaning the county receives about $20,000 per year in revenue. It's also eligible for renewable energy incentive payments, and we receive funds from that, 1.5 cents per kilowatt hour. Varies with the year, of course, and the operation.
Okay, so the Mr. Chair, and to the testifier, private company then is making $1 million a year off the dam, something like that.
Chair, Representative, I have a real cold when sort of choked up. I don't believe, we don't have access to the books for North American Hydro, but I don't believe the vendor has made money on this facility because of the cost to operate and maintain it, repair the generating equipment and the inner gates and so on. They're currently in the process of reinstalling the turbines and generators. They've invested about $2 million in the total rehab on the turbines and generators. So it hasn't been a big profitable operation for them. I don't believe they're making that much real money from it.
Mr. Chair, Representative Mazin, when I went down there and talked to the owners, it's amazing the plans that they have for it, and I think their terms are proper, but like you say, not much, but it's amazing the faith they have, the way they've cleaned it up, put the new turbines in, and painted down there, and they have actual plans to rejuvenate it, and have school tours come down there once they get an agreement with the county to make a station, I think, for the receiving power for, just like you've seen a power plant down there.
Mr. Chair,
Representative Bosman,
I recognize that as all companies are certainly having a financial problem or difficulties, but it seems to me when we're looking at a structure that they depend on for their existence at that location, that they would be listed at least somewhere of providing some funds for this. I see the three-way split, but where is their dollars for this overall activity?
I think it's probably a principal thing with them, Mr. Chairman, too, is that they, like you said, stuck $2 million into it. And, you know, staying in there through the thick and thin and fixing it up the way they have, maybe that's part of it, you know, that extra $60,000 on top of that, so it's not too new. In other words, you wonder why they don't put up the money for this study.
Mr. Chair, I was inquiring. It just seems to me that they should be at least interested in playing a part. Like you say, they have a significant investment there. If this doesn't go forward, if they end up this decision is to not maintain this facility, for all their investment is at risk. Yet we don't see them. I don't see them listed here as a player. Where are they involved in this process? They have a significant interest in this. Yeah, especially with hydro, it's such a we're very interested in trying to see what we can do along those lines, but the development of hydropower just depends upon the government in order to be able to continue to provide the opportunities for hydro. That's not a real free enterprise way to continue to operate on these things.
Mr. Chair, Representative, the contract between the county and North American Hydro puts the responsibility for maintaining and operating, replacing if necessary, container gates and the controls and electrical equipment, the generators, turbines, entirely on private company. They've asked us to participate in the cost of rehabbing the turbines and generators and other things of that sort, and we've refused to do that. It puts the responsibility for the dam, the reservoir structure itself on the county. So that line has been kept very clear, and we've respected that over the years.
Representative Gunther.
As I remember, when NSP sold the dam to Blue Earth County for $2, I think it was, that was the most, $2,000?
$100,000.
That was the best money NSP ever made because they've been going downhill ever since. I think you've averaged a loss of $37,000 a year, as I recall. And I think you have a contract into the future substantial way, so they really can't back out of it too easily.
It's a huge liability for the county, a huge problem for the county. It really is.
Members, do we have any other questions for either Representative Cornish or for Mr. Forsberg? Anyone in the audience have questions or comments? If not,
I'll renew my motion to have this laid over for possible inclusion, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Representative Gunther. We will lay this over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. Members, someone who has taken a look at our previous minutes from March 13th, would someone please move those minutes?
I'll move those, sir.
Representative Gunther moves those. Any more comments or business to come before the committee?
Need to vote on.
Oh, we did not approve. That's what I get for being still a freshman. We did not approve the minutes. We need to vote on that.
Aye.
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 Opposed. Correction. The minutes are approved. We are adjourned.